Welcome to this special Think Tank edition of Prostate Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. We gathered five clinical investigators, Drs. Laurie Klotz, Oliver Sartor, Paul Shellhammer, Matt Smith, and Michael Zalewski, to present cases from their practices and discuss and debate new clinical trial findings and ongoing studies. To begin, Dr. Smith presents a patient with metastatic disease to the bone.
This is a 65-year-old contractor, lives in the Boston area. He has castrate-resistant prostate cancer and bone metastases. He'd been treated with docetaxel for 10 cycles, and his best response was stable disease, and so basically his treatment was discontinued. This is a patient who I'd known since his diagnosis. He had had a prostatectomy about 8 years earlier.
So you saw him when he was first trying to decide about local therapy?
So he had T2, Gleason 7, PSA of about 12. He had had a prostatectomy and then had adjuvant radiation for a positive margin. And then within about 2 years of completing his local treatment, had a brisk rise in PSA with new nodal metastases, and then went on androgen deprivation therapy and eventually progressed. And when he developed bone metastases, then was treated with docetaxel chemotherapy.
So when he started the docetaxel, was he symptomatic from the tumor?
He was asymptomatic.
And I assume healthy, otherwise 65-year-old man?
Yes.
How did he tolerate the docetaxel?
He tolerated it reasonably well. He required no dose reductions or treatment delays, but had the expected side effects of primarily fatigue, some fluid retention, mild anorexia after treatment.
Was he working?
He was working.
What about this issue, Oliver, of treating a patient with asymptomatic metastatic disease with chemo, docetaxel?
I'm comfortable with it, and the data support it as well. You know, we often reach the point where we've exhausted our secondary hormonal manipulations, and I'm a big fan of the secondary hormonal manipulations, as several of my cases might show. But it's the only therapy for metastatic castrate-refractory disease that's been shown to prolong survival. And I don't think we have to wait until there's symptoms. I think in general, I'm utilizing my secondary hormones along the way. And when I reach a point where I think docetaxel is the best therapy for the patient, even if they're asymptomatic, I don't hesitate in using it.
So again, when you first treated him, where were the bone metastases?
So by bone scan, he had diffuse bone metastases, the usual distribution primarily involving his pelvis and spine.
And what was his PSA running around on that point?
At the time he started chemotherapy, his PSA was about 50. And at the completion of chemotherapy, his PSA was about 70. And there was no notable change in his bone scan, although we're all aware of the relative insensitivity of bone scan imaging.
Now, what about bisphosphonates?
So he'd been, upon initiating his chemotherapy, he also began treatment with zoledronic acid. I was treating him on a monthly schedule of docetaxel, and he received zoledronic acid on the same days as his chemotherapy. And his creatinine rose during the course of his therapy from about baseline of 1 to approximately 2. I think while certainly treatment-related renal toxicity needs to be considered in prostate cancer in particular, you have to rule out other common causes like either bladder outlet obstruction or ureteral obstruction, and that was done. He did not have obstruction, and so we attributed his rising creatinine, at least in part, to his treatment with zoledronic acid.
So, Oliver, what would you be thinking about at that point?
Well, actually, I'm less concerned with the skeletal-related events than I am with the patient's progression disease and also his symptoms. So one thing I'd like to know is, from a symptomatic perspective at this point, how's he doing?
So he is minimally symptomatic. You know, 10 months earlier, he'd had really reported no bone pain. In the course of his treatment, he developed a requirement for narcotic analgesics. He's taking oxycodone as needed. So he doesn't require any long-acting narcotics. He's taking a few pills of oxycodone a day for bone pain that's clearly related to sites of metastases with no distinct site of pain. Very common scenario where migratory pain, different locations on different days.
But you felt it was clearly related to the metastatic disease.
It corresponded to sites of metastases, but there was not a single dominant site of pain.
What do you think, Oliver?
Well, there are a couple of options here. And actually, one of the other questions, you know, so how long has he been off the docetaxel at this point?
Just a few months.
Just a few months. And, you know, the data on the 10 cycles of docetaxel is really coming out of the TAX-327 trial. With more recent trials, such as the CLGB trials, able to go up to 2 years. We don't have a huge amount of experience, but certainly One thing I would consider would be docetaxel retreatment, and that's certainly within the realm of possibility. Another thing that is quite helpful in a number of these kind of patients at the borderline, you know, occasional narcotic use, is upping the glucocorticoid dose. And something like dexamethasone in this situation can be surprisingly effective. And in terms of not only helping the progression of the disease, but also managing symptoms. If you're a little more symptomatic, you know, the possibility of the systemic radionuclides, such as samarium 153, might come under consideration.
How about the zoledronic acid?
Well, you know, I have a little concern with that, creatinine, and my focus is probably not on the skeletal-related events, but the overall progression of the disease and the symptoms. So I probably, in this situation, would boost the dose on the glucocorticoids and give strong consideration to reinstituting the docetaxel therapy.
And would you keep the zoledronic acid going?
No, I would not.
So what did you do, Matt?
So we discontinued the zoledronic acid, and I agree with Oliver's assessment that there's two issues to consider. One is management of his underlying malignancy, the critical issue, and then second is what you can do about the bone. He was reluctant to resume chemotherapy at that time, so he was initially followed. I don't routinely treat patients with prednisone with docetaxel, perhaps in contrast to the label, because I think that largely that's historical as to why it's there, and it certainly adds some toxicity. But what I will do is, as you suggest, add in a glucocorticoid at appropriate times. And I preferentially do use Decadron at low dose daily. And you do see some symptomatic benefit, often transient. And occasionally you will see what appears to be at least a dramatic PSA decline. Perhaps you could characterize it as a tumor response. And very occasionally those are durable. So I think it's something worth trying, particularly for patients who prefer not to go on to chemotherapy, either as retreatment with docetaxel or with second-line chemotherapy or a clinical trial. The second issue that arises then, of course, is the management of his bone disease. And I agree with your assessment that he is not a candidate for retreatment with zoledronic acid. And that speaks to the unmet need for other drugs to prevent SREs, perhaps without renal toxicity. And some of those drugs are in development. This is also a setting where I will consider use of radiopharmaceuticals in a patient who is minimally symptomatic or even occasionally asymptomatic. Prostate cancer, clearly more than most other diseases, metastasizes to bone and often has this bone-predominant phenotype, as was the case in this patient. And so sometimes I'll use radiopharmaceuticals, not so much to treat symptoms alone, but to delay or prevent the need for other potentially more morbid salvage therapies.
Mike?
I think another potential option, and this is becoming more popular, is with the advent of stereotactic radiosurgery, where we can give really high doses to limited areas and with tight margins. We have seen, in particular, I've seen in my practice with prostate cancer, when we've treated multiple areas, multiple focal areas, symptomatic improvement and tumor control based on imaging in about 80% of the patients. A concern that's always been around is marrow suppression and the concern of being able to deliver safely more systemic therapies in the future. But with these tight fields that we're now using, again, if it's widespread disease and the pain is all over the place, not a candidate. But if there are three or four areas that are symptomatic, maybe a reasonable suggestion to go with focal stereotactic radiosurgery.
So one of the things we want to ask you, Matt, about was some of the new research that's come out, particularly as it relates to bone. And also there was a paper at ASCO looking at denosumab in prostate cancer. I'd like you to talk about that. And also we pulled off the web yesterday press release related to denosumab and breast cancer. Maybe you can comment on that too.
Sure. So it's a very interesting time in the area of bone-targeted therapy. One of the most exciting advances in basic biology of bone has been recognition of the important role of the receptor activator of NF-kappa-B ligand, or RANK ligand, as a critical mediator of osteoclast differentiation and survival.
Can you kind of explain what the pathway is we're talking
about?
Yeah,
absolutely. So fundamentally, all of the signals that activate osteoclasts, the bone-resorbing cells, are mediated through the osteoblast. And one of the biggest puzzles in bone biology is how the osteoblast communicated with the osteoclasts. So the RANK ligand pathway explains that crosstalk between osteoblasts and osteoclasts.
So the osteoblast secretes something called RANK ligand?
The receptor is RANK, and RANK ligand is the ligand.
Hmm.
So, for example, many of the key signals that affect bone metabolism, parathyroid hormone, vitamin D, gonadal steroids, all mediate those signals, not directly on the osteoclast, but through the osteoblast. And so it's the RANK ligand that's the critical mediator of all the physiologic signals that regulate bone remodeling. Those physiologic mediators that I described have their own receptors on osteoblasts, and then they turn on RANK ligand expression. And then there is a break to this system. It's called osteoprotegerin, which is a decoy receptor which feeds back and inactivates, in the normal situation, RANK ligand.
Okay, that's good. So where do bisphosphonates and denosumab fit into that biology?
Yeah, so bisphosphonates are drugs that adsorb to bone and are taken up by osteoclasts, and they have somewhat different mechanisms according to their relative potency. They induce osteoclast apoptosis, so they inhibit osteoclast activity and kill osteoclasts. Denosumab is a human monoclonal antibody that binds this critical regulator, RANK ligand, and by doing so, inhibits osteoclast differentiation and survival. So put simply, it's a potent osteoclast inhibitor that acts by a completely different mechanism than bisphosphonates.
I've heard people say that bisphosphonates kind of lead to abnormal bone. Is that the case? And does denosumab do that too?
Well, there's been sort of a long theoretical concern that if you potently inhibit osteoclasts, turn off bone remodeling, that you would result in frozen bone. So you wouldn't have the normal low level of bone turnover that's necessary for repair of microfractures, and that you might actually end up with, well, you may have more dense bone, it may be biomechanically weak. There's really no good evidence in either preclinical models or in humans that that is the case. So it's been a long-held theoretical concern, but there's really precious little evidence that that's the case. And, for example, none of the big randomized controlled trials, either in osteoporosis or in cancer, have shown that to be a problem. So bisphosphonates have been an important advance in the supportive care of patients with cancer. In prostate cancer, there is one approved use, and that is to prevent disease-related skeletal complications in men with castrate-resistant metastatic prostate cancer. So one may ask, well, what are the unmet needs? Well, there's unmet needs to have drugs that perhaps are better at doing that, possibly with less side effects. There is a need to prevent bone metastases. That's yet to be demonstrated in prostate cancer.
Although there's some pretty strong suggestion coming out of breast cancer right now.
Absolutely. Very exciting data in breast cancer, both in the past and then more recently with the Gnant study of zoledronic acid. And then the other unmet need is this issue of treatment-related osteoporosis and fractures. While there's a variety of drugs that increase bone mineral density, until recently there's been no demonstration of a fracture benefit.
So in terms of this man, what do you see as the pathophysiology, why there's renal insufficiency, and would you expect that with, say, denosumab or some other bone-protecting agent?
Yeah, so renal toxicity is a well-known but relatively uncommon problem with zoledronic acid. It does require monthly monitoring of serum creatinine, adjustment of the starting dose for patients with renal insufficiency, or as in this case, discontinuation of therapy for patients who develop renal insufficiency while on therapy. So denosumab has no known renal toxicity, so at least by that outcome, appears to have a better safety profile.
What do we know clinically about denosumab, and can you talk a little bit about the ASCO paper?
Sure, absolutely. So this is a first-in-class drug, and so while in early drug development it's clearly a potent osteoclast inhibitor, we really need the results of the phase 3 trials to tell us if this is a clinically useful treatment. So to date, there have been two large randomized controlled trials that denosumab reported. There was the FREEDOM trial of more than 8,000 women with postmenopausal osteoporosis, where denosumab markedly increased bone mineral density and had a dramatic reduction in fractures. The second randomized controlled trial that's been reported is in men on androgen deprivation therapy who were at risk for fractures. And in that study of 1,500 patients, we showed that denosumab significantly increased bone density at all skeletal sites and significantly reduced incident vertebral body fractures, so new vertebral fractures, which was the main secondary outcome for the trial.
Can you talk a little bit more about the data that was presented at ASCO specifically?
Oh, sure. So the primary analysis of that trial reported at EAU, and what we found was that at about 2 years, the increase in BMD of the lumbar spine was about 6 or 7%. So really dramatic improvement in bone mineral density. Surprisingly, there had never been a fracture prevention study in men completed really in any setting. So the data from this denosumab trial provided among the first data we have about fracture prevention in men in general. And what we observed there was that at 3 years, denosumab reduced new vertebral fractures by about 62%, and 2 years, the magnitude was closer to 70%. So that corresponds to really about the best fracture reduction benefit that you would see with any drug in any setting, comparable to the best drugs in postmenopausal osteoporosis and very comparable to the data that was seen in the FREEDOM trial. Now, there was a third trial of denosumab to address this issue of osteoporosis. It was a smaller trial looking at women who were receiving aromatase inhibitors for breast cancer. That study was designed to look at bone mineral density. It was not large enough to look at fractures. And they saw a very similar bone mineral density benefit. And in the ASCO abstract that we presented, we really just looked at the comparative results of the breast and prostate studies and saw very similar magnitude of benefit in BMD between women with breast cancer and men on androgen deprivation therapy for prostate cancer.
What about this study that just came out as a press release in breast cancer showing, quote, superiority over Zometa?
Yeah, so you have two potent osteoclast inhibitors, zoledronic acid and denosumab. And so the question becomes, is denosumab truly a better drug than zoledronic acid? And there are head-to-head trials that are underway, one in breast to prevent SREs, one in prostate cancer to prevent SREs, and a third trial in other common solid tumors to prevent SREs. And one of the real questions
was... Skeletal-related events for our listeners.
Yeah, so skeletal-related events is a clinical trial jargon. And what it really is meant to capture are the clinical complications of bone metastases. I prefer the term in generic use to sort of say disease-related skeletal complications. So operationally, that means pain that requires radiation therapy or surgery, pathologic fractures, those are the main outcomes, as well as spinal cord compression, which is quite relevant in prostate cancer. So the real puzzle that perhaps has been solved, at least in breast cancer with this press release, was whether denosumab could prove itself superior to a good drug like zoledronic acid. And the studies were designed primarily to show non-inferiority with a key secondary analysis to show superiority. And with two potent drugs, it can be hard to tell in advance what the outcomes of the study will be, particularly with a first-in-class drug. So there are two key pieces of data that I think made it quite plausible that denosumab could be superior. First, in this so-called salvage trial reported by Dr. Fazazi, in patients with high bone turnover markers despite a bisphosphonate, denosumab at a very high rate normalized bone markers, so a so-called salvage trial. And then in a second trial, phase 2 dose and schedule finding study, denosumab had fewer skeletal-related events than zoledronic acid in women with metastatic breast cancer. That was a phase 2 trial. What was reported was the top-line data from approximately 2,000-patient trial in metastatic breast cancer, denosumab head-to-head against zoledronic acid. And what was reported is fairly striking in this difficult-to-treat disease state, and that was that denosumab was superior to zoledronic acid with 18 to 23% reduction in skeletal-related events in that study.
What about method of administration, and how often is denosumab given?
So in metastatic disease, the schedule of administration is the same as zoledronic acid. It's monthly. The route of administration is different, subcutaneous rather than intravenous therapy.
Any side effects, allergic reactions?
No allergic reactions. The safety data appears excellent. There's no renal toxicity. And in the press release that was described, there was low rates of osteonecrosis of the jaw in both the zoledronic acid and denosumab-treated subjects.
Interesting. So if that agent were available now, would you put this man on it?
Well, in this case, we don't have the prostate data, to be fair. So we know that the drug is superior to zoledronic acid in breast cancer. The data from a standalone metastatic prostate cancer study is expected certainly in the next 6 months. So we'll have that data soon. And if similar results were seen, then I think it would be an ideal setting to treat this patient, both based on potential superiority to zoledronic acid and then the fact that he would be a candidate despite his renal insufficiency.
I want to get your take on some of the issues with bone and other secondary issues with androgen deprivation in general. But Oliver, any reactions to this whole issue in terms of metastatic disease?
No, I think Matthew captured beautifully, and particularly explaining the pathophysiology in ways that were educational for me. So thank you, Matthew. You know, one thing that I think probably deserves to be said in terms of fracture reduction, you know, there's another compound out there called acapidine. And this is a SERM. It's really terimifen. And there's actually a fraction reduction study in a prospective randomized ADT treatment group, the non-metastatic group. And that trial was also positive, and we're going to have the FDA. And one of the potential advantages for that compound is it reduces hot flashes and restores the lipid profiles that ADT are detrimental to. So this area has become very provocative, potentially have more than one new agent, and intellectually exciting from a translational view as well.
So, Matt, your group also did the terimifene study that was presented at ASCO. Can you talk about that?
No, absolutely. So a study of very similar design to the denosumab fracture prevention study, about 1,400 patients, in this case all from the United States and Mexico, who were receiving androgen deprivation therapy for prostate cancer. The study selected patients who were at somewhat greater risk for fracture based on older age or low baseline bone mineral density. And the subjects in this two-year trial were randomized to terimifene or placebo with the primary outcome of new vertebral fractures.
And I guess we should mention it's an oral agent very similar to tamoxifen.
Yep, so very similar to tamoxifen. And we know that in postmenopausal women, selective estrogen receptor modulators increase bone mineral density and prevent fractures. And there's very compelling data to reach the following conclusion, that is that estrogen is the dominant gonadal steroid that regulates bone metabolism in men and women. So while we use the term androgen deprivation therapy, it's really the unintended estrogen deficiency that appears to account for accelerated bone loss and greater risk for fractures. So that was the rationale for using a selective estrogen receptor modulator in hypogonadal men. So very nice study design, similar to the denosumab trial. And what we observed is that terimifene decreased new vertebral fractures by about 52% at 2 years. As Oliver commented, we also observed significant improvements in lipid profiles, similar to what you see in postmenopausal women. That may be particularly relevant as we think about the other adverse effects of androgen deprivation therapy. And in other secondary analyses, there tended to be fewer hot flashes and less breast symptoms in men who received terimifene. So there appear to be non-skeletal benefits to terimifene, which is certainly understandable based on the mechanism of action. Breast symptoms are common in men receiving androgen deprivation therapy, far more common in men receiving anti-androgen monotherapy, but breast enlargement and breast tenderness are commonly reported symptoms in men on androgen deprivation therapy. And so treatment with a selective estrogen receptor modulator, which by its very name has tissue-specific effects, in this case, improved breast symptoms.
And they did better in terms of vasomotor symptoms? Because we're used to thinking about vasomotor symptoms with tamoxifen.
And they tended to do better with vasomotor symptoms. But it's also worth thinking about the state, right? So if you give a premenopausal woman a selective estrogen receptor modulator, in the milieu of normal high physiologic estrogen levels, a SERM is inhibitory. But in the setting of a profoundly estrogen-deficient man or older woman, a SERM has weak estrogenic activity, presumably in the brain, to confer this reduction in hot flashes.
That's fascinating. So I guess we have to do indirect comparisons at this point. But in your own mind, when you look at what you saw with terimifene, what you saw with denosumab, and I guess what we've seen before with bisphosphonates, how do you think they stack up? And are we looking at this in phase 3 studies?
So to be fair, you know, I'm the global PI of both trials, so it's sort of like asking, you know, which of your two children do you like the best? But I think there's some fair ways to compare the two, and then I'd leave it to others to be more colorful. So at 2 years, terimifene reduced fractures by 52%. Denosumab reduced fractures by 69%. It's unfair to compare the BMD effects because they're different classes of drugs, and that's less relevant than the fracture reduction benefit. But having said that, the BMD effects are greater with denosumab than with terimifene. Safety-wise, denosumab appears more or less completely clean. There's really no notable adverse effects, as is the case in postmenopausal women where SERMs increase the risk for venous thromboembolic events. The same was seen with terimifene. The increase was from 1% in the control group to 2.4% in the terimifene-treated subjects. Denosumab, we would expect to have no non-skeletal benefits, meaning the intention is increase BMD and prevent fractures. Terimifene, we would expect to have non-skeletal benefits, and those were observed, most notably the improvement in lipid profiles.
In terms of indirect comparison, where would bisphosphonates fit in terms of these kinds of numbers?
Well, we don't know. So I think this is a situation where we should appeal to evidence-based medicine. The intention of intervening is to reduce fractures. And so we now have two drugs that have shown a fracture benefit in severely hypogonadal men. We don't have comparable data with bisphosphonates. They've never been adequately evaluated in this setting. They do increase BMD, work of our group and others, but they haven't been evaluated to prevent fractures.
So let me ask my urology colleagues how they think through what they just heard. Laurie?
Well, it's a growth area. And I would say urologists, by and large, have been slow to embrace zoledronic acid, mainly, I think, because it was just cumbersome to administer. You know, the original data is every 3 weeks. Clearly, it doesn't have to be given that often for BMD prophylaxis. But I don't think it's that widely used, and I think it has to do mainly with the inconvenience. But I think the basic approach of urologists embracing the administration of an easy-to-give bone agent makes a lot of sense, and I know that many people are waiting with bated breath to see the denosumab data, and I think also the SERMs clearly have a future.
I think about taking a pill, which, as you describe it, if anything, maybe actually improves their quality of life. It is available. You theoretically could prescribe it, right? Now, do you think that that's something
I want to be clear. It's a different dose than...
Is that right?
It's 80 milligrams, not 60 milligrams. So it's not the same dose that is used to treat breast cancer.
So it's not time to use it off study?
Correct.
But if I can just add one other point. There was an irony with the bicalutamide 150 in the sense that there was a study of tamoxifen to prevent the gynecomastia, which it did quite well. But to me, the large appeal of bicalutamide 150 as an alternative to androgen deprivation is its favorable effect on bone mineral density.
It increases estrogen level.
It increases testosterone. There's peripheral conversion to estrogen. You give tamoxifen, and it blocks the gynecomastia, but it also presumably blocks the benefit on bone mineral density. Although that actually hasn't been studied that I'm aware of. But I mean, tamoxifen has an adverse effect on bone mineral density. And so in a way, it kind of threw the baby out with the bathwater, I thought. So the idea of a SERM, the double whammy of reducing the hot flashes, which is really a major issue. Unlike a lot of what we're talking about, the effect on bone mineral density is not something that patients are aware of, but hot flashes they're very aware of. And to reduce that, I think, will be very appealing to patients, given that there's maybe a roughly comparable effect to the bone-specific agents.
Paul, how do you think urologists right now are thinking through the bone issue, particularly you're talking about 3 years of therapy before, and what do you think about what you just heard?
Well, I don't think urologists think through the bone issue adequately. And because, as Laurie mentioned, patients aren't complaining of that, and oftentimes the side effect, which is a fracture, is years down the line in another hospital that they're not aware of. There's not the one-on-one clinical relationship, but all this information is building that urologists, if they give ADT, need to become very familiar with bone physiology and with therapeutic alternatives, and both of these sound very exciting. Of course, the pill is interesting, namely the SERM, and I'll ask Matt, because I think I read an abstract that also it affected PSA, and it was a retrospective look, but didn't the Taremifen trial look at PSA and show there was either a diminution or stabilization of PSA in these patients?
Yeah, so if it's okay, I'll take your question as a more general one, and that is sort of, can we get a two-for-one in that? Can we prevent fractures and delay or prevent disease progression, either in bone or at other sites? And that really remains an open question. And, for example, metastasis prevention is an unmet need. I'll comment on in a moment. But it's really hard to get two-for-one. So there has been some assessments that have looked at this issue. And perhaps there's a suggestion that there's less PSA progression with trimethine. But in studies that weren't designed for that purpose, there's limited amounts of information you can get from that. In much the same way that we'd love to be able to tell you from the completed fracture prevention study whether either of these agents prevents bone metastases, but you simply can't do it because the patients, by the very clinical trial design, are at too low a risk for developing bone mets.
You know, we did a program called Year in Review of Breast Cancer. We profiled the 53 most important papers. And actually, our number one paper of the year was the Austrian study that Matt was referring to, New England Journal paper presented in ASCO 2008 as a plenary session where, I mean, and this had been seen before, but it hadn't been seen for a while. These women had fewer metastases, fewer progressions, like a third fewer. And, you know, people are still trying to sort out what to do about it. What do you think about that? What do we know about bisphosphonates or bone interfering agents and disease progression?
Well, we have the expert over to my right, so I'll quote some of his papers if he doesn't mind. Matthew published a paper that looked at zoledronic acid in terms of prevention of metastatic disease, but it was a trial that was aborted early. The number of endpoints, the rate at which the endpoints are being reached was really slower than anticipated. The important lesson from that trial was a risk stratification, and this is my interpretation. The important lesson was being able to risk stratify these patients for who was going to get the bony metastatic disease and understanding the rate at which they would do so. So certain PSA doubling times turned into a risk stratification method that was then applied. So the denosumab trial in this setting, which also is going to be looking at metastasis prevention as measured perhaps not with the best techniques, but nevertheless measured with bone scans, is now underway, completed accrual, and we're going to be awaiting results. So it's an exciting concept. If I were to venture out and start to say that it's going to be positive or negative, I'd certainly be reading tea leaves that I don't really see very clearly today. But it's a provocative concept, and one's being tested.
One of the things that was really interesting, Matt, about those data was that there was a decrease in other metastasis, not just bone. And Martine Picard Gebhardt did this seed and soil discussion afterwards, talking about what the relationship might be between bone targeting agents or bisphosphonates and metastases. If we could do the trial correctly, what do you think we would find?
In prostate cancer?
Yeah, well, I think prostate cancer.
I believe we have done the trial correctly now. We just don't have the results. And as Oliver alluded to, the challenge is one of pure clinical trial design. A very well-intended study of zoledronic acid in men with castrate-resistant non-metastatic prostate cancer failed because the event rate was too low. So if you have too low of an event rate, you can never learn whether your drug was effective or not. So the insight from that trial was better patient selection, as Oliver had described. And so we used that data to inform the design of a global study, in this case of denosumab, to prevent bone metastases. So the patient population are as follows: men with prostate cancer, castrate resistant, no history of bone metastases, meticulously screened not to have current bone metastases, but to be at high risk based on not just castrate resistant disease, but PSA and PSA kinetics, roughly corresponding to, say, the worst half of patients with castrate resistant disease. That was a major undertaking to have that selection criteria. The study involved about 300 investigative sites in 30 countries. It's fully accrued, 1,500 patients. It's an event-driven analysis and is on track to have at least top-line readout in the first quarter of 2010. So
with
as much certainty as I can say, the study's been designed with the right patient population, high enough risk to have the right event rate. The ascertainment, I just want to follow up on the ascertainment of bone metastases, is meticulous. It's not based solely on bone scans. There's very powerful, well-designed central review of all radiographic imaging with feedback to sites requiring confirmatory scans in all cases. So they'll be very, as good as you can get in prostate cancer, confirmed new bone metastases. So I'm very confident, as much as one can be, about the outcome of new bone metastases in this trial. Now the question is whether the study design work and whether the drug is effective.
If it turns out that there's an effect on non-bone metastasis, what do you think the mechanism might be, either for bisphosphonates or denosumab?
Yeah, so I suppose because of the pattern of metastases, one could argue that prostate cancer is the right disease to study to look at bone metastasis prevention. In diseases like breast cancer, bone-only metastases is uncommon, where it's more the rule in prostate cancer. But to answer your question directly, so what are the mechanisms? I mean, I think one of the more provocative ones is that there's really trafficking through the bone marrow. So even, say, metastases that ultimately appear clinically in lymph nodes, liver, lung, that they require trafficking through the bone marrow. And if you alter the bone microenvironment, you might impact the development of disease at other sites.
Last thing I want to ask you, Matt, is you've published and done great work in terms of other secondary effects of androgen deprivation therapy, cardiovascular disease, et cetera. Anything new that's come out? We have a paper from the JCO that was just published on this. Any new data sets that shed more light on that issue?
Yeah, so it's really terrific to see the amount of work that's gone on in this field, and most of that very nicely hypothesis-driven. I mean, it's clear to anyone who's ever treated men with prostate cancer that androgen deprivation therapy results in increased fat mass and abdominal girth. That's what men complain about first. And we and others have shown, using more complicated methods to demonstrate the same clinical observation, that androgen deprivation therapy increases fat mass. It's primarily subcutaneous fat. This is not just a cosmetic issue. There's metabolic consequences of elevated triglycerides primarily, but also cholesterol and decreased insulin sensitivity.
Is this a classic metabolic syndrome or something a little bit different?
Yeah, so at the risk of becoming too obscure about this, this is a metabolic syndrome. It's not the metabolic syndrome. There are very clear differences from the classically defined metabolic syndrome. So what they share in common is increased abdominal girth, increased triglycerides, and fundamentally insulin resistance. Almost everything else is different. So metabolic syndrome is visceral fat. ADT is subcutaneous fat. Metabolic syndrome is low HDL. Androgen deprivation therapy increases HDL cholesterol. And there are other markers that are different. Metabolic syndrome is low adiponectin levels, high C-reactive protein. ADT is high adiponectin levels, no change in C-reactive protein. So there are very clear differences from the classic metabolic syndrome. And I think it's better not to make direct references to this as the metabolic syndrome. Things that are called syndromes are named as such because of lack of understanding about the underlying pathophysiology, and the classic metabolic syndrome is no exception.
If you were to see a patient who's about to begin, you know, 3 years of androgen deprivation therapy, what kind of advice would you give?
Yeah, so first is just recognition of the problems, and I think if we do that, our patients stand a better chance to fare better. But the hand that delivers androgen deprivation therapy, either directly or in writing the prescription, needs to be the same one that considers the potential side effects. And this is where I think urology, which has, if I accept what Dr. Klotz said, has moved more in a medical direction, will need to continue to do so. And I'd like to hear more from my urology colleagues about that issue. But what I advise men is that first, these are the risks, that the problems of fractures, obesity, diabetes, and possibly cardiovascular disease are real risks, but they're not inevitable consequences of treatment. So while we increase the risk of these common comorbid medical conditions, it is not inevitable that every man on androgen deprivation therapy will have fractures, develop diabetes, and cardiovascular disease. Why is that? Because there's individual patient differences in the outcomes. The risks for some of these outcomes are modest, particularly that of cardiovascular disease. And some of these are preventable, as we just talked about in the issue of fractures. But we really need to take a look at the entire patient. And this concept or terminology of survivorship, I think, is now well ingrained in the culture of prostate cancer. And I think we need to continue that tradition and really pay attention to patients and consider these risks as they go on long-term treatment in particular.
I'm kind of surprised about your comment about cardiovascular disease. A lot of people, Anthony D'Amico, for example, very concerned about it, think it's very common.
Well, we're clearly very concerned about it. So out of the work showing increased obesity, triglyceride elevation, and insulin resistance, our group was the first to look at the issue of androgen deprivation therapy and greater risk for these clinical outcomes. And in a landmark study in JCO, my colleague Nancy Keating and I reported that androgen deprivation therapy with GnRH agonists is associated with greater risk for new diagnosis of diabetes and cardiovascular disease. The observations about fractures have been made by a variety of groups previously. And the observation about diabetes has been confirmed in subsequent studies by our group and independently by at least two other groups. The issue of cardiovascular disease is, though, a lot more complicated. We've seen the same results looking at a different database, looking at new diagnosis of cardiovascular disease. The group in Ontario, Dr. Alibi and JCO, showed an increased risk for diabetes, but no increased risk for cardiovascular disease. And it's important to note that in our SEER Medical analyses by Dr. Keating, the relative risk was fairly modest. These are conservative estimates by the design of the trial, but we're looking at less than 20% increase in risk.
Relative
increase. Relative. So hazard ratio is less than 1.2. So the observation, though, of greater cardiovascular disease risk in a study that included more than 70,000 patients led to a variety of attempts to look at whether ADT is associated with greater cardiovascular mortality. Now, let's think this through. If there's a 20% increase in risk of developing a disease, we can reasonably assume that all those events are not fatal, right? So to look at mortality, you would have to design a trial that would have the power to look at, say, 0 to 15% increase in mortality. But there's no such trial that's been done. And there's been a variety of retrospective analyses by a variety of groups, nearly all of which have showed no increase in cardiovascular mortality. There's been a few trials that have reported greater cardiovascular mortality, but in every case, we're restricted to specific subsets, not to the overall patient population. And by the way, all of the trials that we're talking about here, at most, had a couple of hundred deaths. We're talking about the retrospective sort of analyses of cardiovascular mortality. In our study that found an association with new diagnosis of cardiovascular disease, we had 73,000 participants and many thousands of events. So the consistent observation about mortality is that there is no excess cardiovascular mortality, and there's been a few studies to report otherwise. This is what Dr. Alibi found in his Ontario study, and another very relevant recent publication is the BOLA study looking at short versus long-term androgen deprivation therapy. And in that trial, as a specific secondary analysis, they looked at the issue of cardiovascular mortality and really saw completely overlapping curves. We found the same in RTOG 9202, which was similarly high-risk, locally advanced prostate cancer, short versus long-term androgen deprivation therapy with no excess cardiovascular mortality. We also found the same in RTOG 8531, which is no ADT versus long-term ADT, and in that trial, absolutely overlapping cardiovascular mortality. So I think the clear message that we need to tell patients is ADT increases obesity, decreases insulin sensitivity, increases risk for diabetes and fractures, and may increase risk for cardiovascular disease. The last thing we want to do is scare appropriate patients who require treatment in evidence-based settings from therapy. That's absolutely the wrong message. But I think it speaks volumes about two issues. One is in settings for which there is no evidence of an overall survival advantage, we need to be very careful about choosing patients for androgen deprivation therapy, or said a different way, avoid overtreatment. And in patients who require treatment in those evidence-based settings, then it's our obligation to take care of these issues of survivorship.
Laurie?
I just want to reinforce that I think the idea that this is a metabolic syndrome, not the metabolic syndrome, and it looks to me like it's not nearly as dangerous an entity as the metabolic syndrome. And maybe the HDL is protective. Maybe the lack of visceral fat is protective. But, you know, the Studer randomized trial of early versus deferred hormonal therapy actually showed an 11% improvement in other cause mortality in the early group. In other words, fewer deaths in the group with longer duration of hormones. And we have a large randomized trial of intermittent versus continuous, with now many patients treated for more than 10 years on either intermittent or continuous. Absolutely no difference in any cardiovascular rate. So I think I completely agree with your point. We may have overstated this a little bit, and there is a risk. I mean, these drugs have side effects, but they are not toxic, in my opinion, in the sense that they should be avoided in patients who need them.
Mike?
I think Matthew alluded to this. A subset analyses that have been looked into these patients who have pre-existing cardiovascular disease, and we're seeing them often the older patient for hormonal therapy. And I guess a question I'd like to ask you is, a patient who has pre-existing atherosclerotic heart disease, are these the patients who are destined to get long-term hormonal therapy? Are these patients being recommended to get baseline stress tests? Would you recommend that before we start them on a two-year or three-year course of hormones?
So the short answer is I would not be advising them to get a baseline stress test. I'd be advising them to see the person who's managing their cardiovascular disease, and I would communicate with that physician directly. So if they have a cardiologist or an internist who's managing that, to communicate with that physician, let them know about the planned treatment and the expected side effects. So the other physician will understand why their cholesterol is not as well controlled once they're on androgen deprivation therapy, and why this patient who they've been carefully advising about weight loss is now gaining weight. So I've met countless patients over the years who have been berated by their primary care physician for years about their inability to lose weight and suggestion that they're non-compliant with their Lipitor, when in fact the primary care provider failed to understand that, for quite justifiable reasons, that in fact it was the patient's prostate cancer treatment that was largely accounting for these problems.
But if these patients have serious coronary artery disease to begin with, would your recommendation be to limit the duration of hormonal therapy?
In certain cases, I have done that. I've taken the bull by the horn, so to speak, and say, you know, while we can conclude that longer-term treatment improves survival from the BOLA data from RTOG-9202 and perhaps others, we can also agree that the magnitude of that benefit is relatively small, and you do have to consider the trade-offs. And ultimately, I think we are then put in the responsibility, not the internist, of deciding whether they need treatment. But I like to put the internist or the cardiologist in the place of optimizing their medical management of their underlying cardiovascular disease and us making the decisions about duration of treatment. And in some cases, actually, no androgen deprivation therapy. One might also take it a little bit further and say if their cardiovascular disease is severe enough, whether they need treatment at all.
And what about a six-month duration of hormonal therapy? Do you think that these effects are still prevalent there for short courses?
Yeah, that's a great question. So for fractures, absolutely not. While the worst of the bone loss is in the first year, the fracture issue is a long-term issue. So I really don't worry particularly about 6 months of androgen deprivation therapy for fractures, except that some of those patients will eventually go on to long-term treatment. The other metabolic effects, muscle loss, fat accumulation, lipid alterations, most of the long-term effect accumulates in the first 3 to 6 months. So those metabolic effects are early adverse effects and must be considered even in patients on short-term therapy. Having said that, I think it'd be desirable to limit duration of treatment in patients for high risk for other medical problems.
Paul, I know medical oncologists are going to be interested in the kinds of things that Matt's talking about. What about urologists? Are they interested in this? Do they want to hear it?
I hope so. I hope they want to hear it because it's fascinating.
I mean, really, what's your take?
They are instituting the disease process by writing the script, and so they have to be knowledgeable about the outcomes of what they're doing, and they have to advise the patient. Now, Matt used the term survivorship. I like to use the word participant because the patient now is participating in a long-term process with the physician giving direction, the patient doing his diet, exercise, and other stuff that's important. So I can't see prescribing a regimen of therapy and separating your knowledge and direction with regard to the iatrogenic complications of that therapy.
Oliver, what about the issue of muscle loss and androgen deprivation?
Well, you know, one of the things men complain about, hot flashes, central obesity, and muscle loss. So muscle loss is something we really haven't given much focus to. And it's become a very provocative area. And more than one company now is in the process of trying to develop agents that will reverse this ADT-induced muscle loss. And, you know, it's too preliminary now to say that these are things going to be impacting practice in the next year or two. But as a thought experiment, being able to potentially help men prevent that muscle loss that ADT induces is an area that I think clinicians need to be aware of going forward.
Matt, can you kind of quantify what the problem is clinically and also what the mechanisms are?
Yes, I'm not sure we understand the precise mechanisms, but unmistakably, there are fairly dramatic changes in body composition that occur as an early adverse effect of ADT. So say at 1 year, most of this would be apparent in the first 3 months, men gain about relative increase in fat mass of about 8 to 10% and about a 3% decrease in muscle mass. So for the average man, you shift several kilograms of muscle for fat, 2 to 3 kilograms of muscle for fat on ADT.
And that sounds like a lot.
It is a lot.
And several kilograms.
Yeah, like 2 or 3 kilograms.
Wow. I don't know if I have 2 or 3 kilograms of muscle. I guess I do.
Well, you're good. So, you know, the average 80-kilogram American man is going to be probably 30% fat mass. The most of the rest is lean body mass. You know, it's not all muscle, but the point is it's lean body mass. So it's about a 3% decrease depending on your body size and where you start from, 2 to 3 kilogram muscle loss. And for the typical man, we have a fair amount of reserve so that they're not going to notice that in their usual daily activities. But for men who already may have some mild functional impairment or are living right on the edge, that can really have substantial impact. The muscle loss that accompanies ADT may plausibly also contribute to fracture risk. So if you become frail on ADT and at greater risk for falls, that may well contribute to fracture risk. And then it certainly, I think, in some ways impacts quality of life. It may be partially responsible for some of the fatigue. And patients who are very physically active will notice an impairment in their ability to exercise and do things. And this is one of the major obstacles about our common advice, which is we advise men to exercise more, but because of the other unintended effects of ADT, it becomes more difficult. And having thought about this a lot and spoken with lots of men about this, I think it relates a lot to recovery after strenuous physical activity. You know, some athletes use anabolic steroids to train in part because they have faster recovery after vigorous training sessions. It probably is the opposite effect. And of course, in the general population, the treatment for sarcopenia in hypogonadal men would be to give testosterone. We can't do that in the setting of prostate cancer. And so other avenues would be necessary. And as Oliver alluded to, there are some drugs in development that may be very relevant here because they're non-testosterone approaches to building muscle.
So I want to shift again into this area of new agents. We've been talking about a number of them so far. And I want to ask Oliver to maybe start with one of your cases. Maybe we can talk a little bit about the issue of, you know, where clinical trials fit in the patient with prostate cancer, particularly with hormone refractory disease. So can you talk about this man?
Sure. And this is a tough case. It was a guy from Alabama. He owned a furniture store, kind of gone through the usual androgen deprivation therapy, had some second-line bicalutamide.
Where did you encounter him?
I encountered him actually where this case starts.
Right.
It was post-docetaxel.
So an oncologist had given him docetaxel? Or?
Yeah. He had already been treated with hormones, been treated with secondary hormones, been treated with ketoconazole, been treated with docetaxel, and now he's progressing. He has diffuse disease, bone and lymph nodes. He is symptomatic. He's having pain. His PSA is doubling on about every three-week basis. At this point, he had actually had an initial nice response to the docetaxel and then was progressing through it.
Still working?
He was still working, but it was starting to get really tough, and he was taking morphine and other narcotics in order to control his pain.
What was his state of mind, and what was his family situation?
A lovely wife, very concerned, desperate. Still had a pretty good performance status, even though he was having the pain, having the narcotics. They really wanted some more therapy. And they showed up on my doorstep saying, you know, please help, do something.
And when was this?
This was last summer. It was almost exactly a year ago.
Okay. So before we talk about what happened, Matt, what are some of the trials a patient like that today might go in or that you might have available? And what are some of the trials that maybe a couple years ago or a year ago when he presented were going on and now we're waiting for results?
So this is the guy who's had docetaxel, is that correct?
Yes.
So he had
about seven cycles, yeah. Initially responded, yeah. Now progressing. Actually had a nice response.
Yeah.
And now he's progressing and progressing rapidly by PSA, and his symptoms are significant.
Yeah, so, you know, one of the important things about the approval of docetaxel, of course, it brought a new therapeutic to patients with a documented survival benefit compared to older chemotherapy. And it also kind of helped define standard of care, which has helped clarify clinical trial design in recent years. And so a common clinical trial setting now is post-docetaxel salvage therapy. And I think it's fair to say there's no standard of care, and there's really actually precious little data, large long-term data about outcomes in that setting. Mitoxantrone is an approved therapy. It was approved before docetaxel and is commonly used after docetaxel, but the expectations about efficacy there are quite modest.
Response, do you use it?
I do. And occasionally see a dramatic response, but I mean, one could say that about many things in prostate cancer. Different mechanism of action, different primary mechanisms of resistance. So I do use it in that setting, but not with great enthusiasm. And I'd much rather apply a clinical trial if there's a suitable patient. Now, one of the challenges, because there is no standard of care, many of those clinical trials are placebo-controlled, and there are some patients who just are not going to be appropriate candidates for a placebo-controlled trial because of current symptoms. And it sounds like that may be the case here for this man with a declining performance status and, as I understand it, some pain. But there's a number of very interesting trials that either recently completed accrual or ongoing. The first pivotal study of abiraterone is in this setting, abiraterone, prednisone versus prednisone, in this docetaxel failure population. with the primary endpoint of survival. We all anxiously await the results of that trial. There are other drugs in development there as well, based on evidence of some efficacy of sunitinib in castrate-resistant prostate cancer. There's another placebo-controlled trial in exactly this setting of docetaxel failures with castrate-resistant metastatic disease. That's a global trial. Accrual is ongoing. And it's my understanding that the Medivation 3100 antiandrogen may first be evaluated in a pivotal trial in this setting.
Oliver, can you talk a little bit more about the clinical trials, for example, that a patient like this might go in today?
Sure. Let me start with those that accrued, because actually we do know a little more about the space right now than what we used to. So there's a trial called the SPARC trial with satraplotin, 900 patients, global trial. I was one of the co-PIs. And the data from that will be presented in JCO. And the bottom line is that we learned that these patients live about 14 months. We also learned that the satraplotin, which is an oral platin, did not prolong survival. It did prolong some progression-free survival, and there were some symptomatic benefits. But in terms of being able to pass FDA muster, the answer was no. So we learned about the natural history, but not, unfortunately, being able to change treatment paradigms.
What about the issue of first-line therapy in these patients and adding agents to docetaxel?
Sure. Well, ever since docetaxel was approved, the hope has been that we'll be able to add something to it and do better. The trial that it completely accrued actually in 07, completed accrual in December of 07, the CLGB trial, looking at bevacizumab. And that trial is going to be reported out in the pretty near future. I mean, I was actually anticipating that we'll have results this summer. Certainly by the fall, I would anticipate results. Like I said, completed accrual December of 07.
And that's docetaxel alone versus docetaxel plus bevacizumab?
Yeah, each side with prednisone, because the TAX-327 in the label does, in fact, indicate the prednisone 5-BID. Perhaps of historical interest, perhaps not. It's conjectural.
And we just saw adjuvant data presented at the ASCO meeting in colon cancer for bevacizumab, and of course it's being utilized mainly with chemotherapy in a variety of tumors, including lung, breast, colon, ovary, renal. What do we know about bevacizumab in prostate cancer?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, there's reasonable rationale. We have data to indicate that VEGF, the vascular endothelial growth factor, which bevacizumab will actually bind to and block, is associated with worse prognosis. We have other angiogenesis markers that have been associated with worse prognosis. We have the precedent of other diseases, colorectal, et cetera, where intervening with this agent adds benefit when given in combination with chemotherapy. So, you know, there's a good preclinical rationale. In terms of clinical data, a couple trials, there was a phase 2 trial, non-randomized phase 2, that indicated that you could have a pretty reasonable prolonged progression-free survival data, but not being randomized, a little bit hard to interpret. And then there was
that was with chemo?
That was with docetaxel plus bevacizumab in a non-randomized phase 2. And then in the refractory, the docetaxel refractory setting, there was a report. And to me, it was kind of surprisingly positive that patients who had failed the docetaxel would go on the docetaxel bevacizumab, and clearly a number of patients responded in that trial, and I thought gave better results than we might have anticipated a priori. Now, part of the problem is off-label use, very expensive compound. I didn't talk about that in my case because getting the insurances to cover bevacizumab off indication is very tough and potentially kills the patient's pocketbook. So we didn't really address that with the patient, although it could be construed as an alternative.
Can you talk a little bit more about angiogenesis and cancer and prostate cancer, where bevacizumab fits in? Matt mentioned sunitinib. What's the difference there?
Actually, let me start at the beginning. So Judah Folkman, who was a surgeon, Children's Hospital up in Boston, had been sort of ranting about this for decades before anybody paid attention. And in fact, it was worse than not paying attention. He was actually booed and hissed when the concept came up, because what he raised was the fact is that tumors can't grow without their blood vessels expanding along with it. And he really proposed the concept that taking an anti-angiogenic therapy, an anti-vessel type strategy, could be useful in treating cancer. And of course, years and years and years, decades went by before there was real clinical proof of that concept. But today, we have proof on the left hand, proof on the right hand, and agents such as bevacizumab, agents such as sunitinib, you know, are really predicated on that hypothesis. So if we look at bevacizumab, getting back to your subsequent question, if we look at mechanism of action, you know, it's a monoclonal antibody that will bind into this angiogenesis regulator, so-called vascular endothelial growth factor, VEGF, and inhibits VEGF and binds to it. And then other compounds such as sunitinib actually operate by binding to kinases and being able to inhibit signaling.
So they're small molecules, you give them orally, and they work inside the cell.
Correct. And so the mechanism of action of not only this particular angiogenic factors, but potentially others as well, is a signal transduction pathway that involves phosphorylation. And this is a kinase inhibitor. And so this concept of kinase inhibitor small molecules has actually been permeating through oncology. And there are a whole variety of them used, you know, lung cancer and other cancers. And we're looking at it sort of as a monoclonal. And then there are other strategies. There's a compound called aflibercept. It's what's called a VEGF trap. And it comes in, and it's not a monoclonal, but it traps the VEGF. So this pathway of angiogenesis and VEGF inhibition is now a very hot topic in oncology. But truthfully, the proof of principle, the one that got people excited, I think primarily was the bevacizumab studies in colon cancer.
And it's interesting, Matt, I mean, to think about the fact that maybe in the next few months, we're going to maybe have a new strategy to treat men with prostate cancer. Of course, obviously, it depends upon that CALGB trial. And of course, bevacizumab is used a lot in oncology. What do we know about side effects, complications, and also for the angiogenic TKIs like sunitinib?
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly what we know about the safety of Avastin in other settings. We'll obviously have to wait the results of the trial to find out what it's like in this patient population. But I expect that it'll be comparable to that was seen in breast cancer, perhaps a little bit worse because of the fact that our patients are older and have had other therapies. So there will be more toxicity in the Avastin-treated group. And one hopes that the combination therapy will translate into a better overall survival. I think we also have to prepare ourselves for the possibility that it will look much like it did in breast cancer and that there'll be a progression-free survival benefit without any overall survival benefit. So if the past is any indication, that is, I think, a plausible outcome, but I certainly hope that we'll see an overall survival benefit.
I guess one thing about that we've seen in metastatic disease is because it's a monoclonal antibody in terms of quality of life and side effects, it's, you know, like trastuzumab, for example, what we hear from oncologists is that it's relatively well tolerated. Is that your take?
Well, I treated plenty of patients on the trial. It's a blinded trial, so I don't know which got which. But I saw some toxicities that I otherwise wouldn't have expected or greater severities. But anecdotes are what they are, so we'll await the results of the trial to really sort that out. But unmistakably, in the breast cancer studies, there was some toxicities that you otherwise wouldn't observe without the Avastin. I think it's a very exciting time. I have a great deal of interest in what comes after docetaxel, because I think the model that we really probably need to follow is primarily sequential therapy in that disease state. So I worry a little bit about the model of stacking therapies on top of therapies. So one of the concepts that many of the cooperative groups have discussed, for example, is, okay, if docetaxel Avastin is the winner in that trial, the next logical trial is then to do a three-drug trial, right? But I do worry a lot about the utility of that approach in a general patient population.
And actually, we were talking, you know, bevacizumab is very exciting in glioma. In our think tank yesterday, that was a big topic of discussion. I guess one of the things, Oliver, that does happen is you see unusual issues such as proteinuria, hypertension, nosebleed. Do we have any safety data right now? What's been seen in these other prostate cancer studies in terms of those kinds of problems that seem like they're pretty manageable? Is that your take?
My take is it's going to be pretty manageable. There is one issue that could be a little bit of a surprise. And this was reported out of the National Cancer Institute. They used a combination that stacked a fair amount on top of docetaxel. So docetaxel, prednisone, thalidomide, bevacizumab reported extraordinary response rates. And they were giving zoledronic acid along the way. The incidence of ONJ, the osteonecrosis of the jaw, exceeded 10%, far higher than anything that had ever been seen before. And it's conceivable that as you're combining the zoledronic acid, you got an older population, you got a little bevacizumab, maybe that inhibits new blood vessel growth, you're given the taxotere, you got the prednisone in there. It's conceivable that we could have some side effects we didn't quite anticipate. In terms of proteinuria, hypertension, there are going to be some DVTs, there are probably going to be some arterial thrombotic events. I think those are going to be kind of anticipated and manageable. But until we see the data, I am somewhat cautiously optimistic, but still cautious.
And I guess, Laurie, too, another issue with bevacizumab has been wound healing. Maybe if the ONJ thing, maybe somehow that's related. Right now, I guess that's not going to be an issue in terms of prostate cancer.
Yeah, it's an issue that's come up in kidney cancer, although supposedly not a big issue. But I haven't heard too much about that. I guess people use
like a six-week window between any kind of surgery.
There's anecdotal case mostly of patients having surgery on those drugs or immediately after discontinuing. And for what it's worth, they don't seem to have an excessive problem with wound healing. But I personally haven't yet had that experience with a patient.
Well, one other area that's very provocative is being able to combine these newer targeted agents with radiation as well. And one of the rare side effects of the bevacizumab are actually GI perforation. And if you're talking about prostatic radiation and an agent that may increase the risk of GI perforation, you know, that could be a bad interaction. So there's a little bit of data coming out of Seattle right now. There's an RTOG trial that's going to be addressing giving the bevacizumab in combination with radiation. But, you know, there's caution.
Do you know anything about it, Mike, in terms of the whole issue of combining bevacizumab and radiation in prostate cancer?
I know that, as Oliver mentioned, there's a lot of interest in it, and there's some animal studies that demonstrated radiosensitivity. We've actually, at our institution, we have used it in combination with radiation for gliomas.
That's what I was going to say. That's what they were talking about yesterday, to normalize the blood vessels.
Exactly, and the preliminary results look actually very good for that group of patients. So especially there's a lot of interest in the laboratory data indicating that when you use higher doses per fraction, you engage a different mechanism of cell kill, endothelial apoptosis, and using bevacizumab together with radiation, especially when you're using higher doses per fraction, may give a dramatic radiosensitivity.
What other strategies are being looked at, again, in the first-line setting in terms of maybe combining something with docetaxel and biologics, et cetera?
Well, there are actually a whole number of trials that are now in progress. There's a compound called ZD454. It's an endothelin antagonist, endothelin receptor A antagonist. And they had some very provocative monotherapy phase 2 results, randomized phase 2. And it's coming in to the clinic right now, and that trial's accruing pretty well.
Can you explain a little more about how it works? That's another pathway that, you know, trying to figure out.
Yeah, I've tried to figure it out too, Neil. But there's a compound called endothelin, and endothelin is present in the circulation, it's present in the prostate and also some other tissues. And it interacts with two receptors, endothelin A receptor and endothelin B receptor.
And where does it come from?
It is, Matthew, help me out here. I know it's produced in prostate and it's...
Well, it's a normal regulatory protein. It's thought to be involved in perception of pain.
Really?
It is present in the bone microenvironment. And for reasons that perhaps aren't well understood, it's made in high concentrations in the prostate. It's actually very high concentrations in the ejaculate. And it's a potent vasoconstrictor, and I believe part of its normal physiologic role in the ejaculate is that it participates in the formation of the seminal clot. So,
seminal clot?
Coagulum. Yeah. Seminal coagulum.
Yeah. What's that?
That's after ejaculation. Initially, the seminal fluid coagulates, and the function of PSA is to liquefy the seminal coagulum.
It has a normal physiologic function, and then really nice early work by Joel Nelson and others. Following along that observation, wanted to look at the role of this in prostate cancer and found that higher grade and metastatic prostate cancers, patients with those conditions, had higher serum levels of endothelin 1. And the very interesting story was that at the time, Abbott Pharmaceuticals was developing an endothelin 1 receptor antagonist for their cardiovascular program. And as sort of a bit of serendipity, Joel Nelson approached the company about looking at this agent as a treatment for prostate cancer.
And what was that called?
Atrasentan.
Atrasentan.
So,
and bottom line, what do we find out about atrasentan, Oliver?
Well, as monotherapy, unfortunately, it did not have enough of an impact to pass FDA muster. And there was some meta-analysis sort of combined trials that were attempted to get it over the FDA hump, but that didn't occur. So the bottom line is it did not affect survival. And the atrasentan is also one of these agents in combination with docetaxel in trial today. There's a SWOG trial that looks at docetaxel plus or minus atrasentan, and then the trial with ZD454, which is their endothelin A antagonist. And, of course, they believe that, of course, it may be a little bit better.
Atrasentan was a fairly specific inhibitor, but this is more selective and more potent than atrasentan. But same target.
Yeah, I mean, to me, the target is endothelin A, and then they both hit the target.
Right.
The kinetics or the binding affinity is better, but from a conceptual perspective, in terms of the A, it's maybe binds a little better, but I didn't know there was more.
Endothelin B is an inhibitory receptor, so there might be situations where that selectivity is important.
Yeah, what about if they're both oral?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And side effects and toxicity, what do you see?
Headaches, nasal stuffiness, leg edema. Potentially a little bit of congestive heart failure, increased risk, perhaps from fluid retention. Pretty well tolerated, though.
Have you ever used it yourself, either one of them?
I've used them in clinical trials. I haven't used them.
Yeah.
I haven't taken them myself yet, Neil.
So. But you've treated patients with these agents in trials?
Yes, I have.
Most of them sail through. A lot of them have problems kind of globally. How do they tolerate it?
Fine. You know, I mean, I've complaints about some runny noses and some leg edema. Had one patient develop a little shortness of breath. It was a placebo-controlled trial. I'm not exactly sure what it was on, but I attribute it potentially because he was retaining a little fluid potentially to the experimental agent.
And this is just being looked at with chemo or also by itself?
It's being looked at in other settings as well. The ZD454 actually has three trials, one with chemo, one in the metastatic patient without chemo, kind of the minimally symptomatic patient, and then a third trial where you have the so-called M0, the non-metastatic state but progressive disease. So there are three trials that are being performed with that particular agent. Maybe to get back to one of the questions you asked about earlier, so what else is being given in combination with docetaxel and the bevacizumab and the VEGF trap, and aflibercept that I mentioned a little bit earlier, dasatinib, which is an interesting agent, you know, FDA approved for the CML setting. It's a kinase inhibitor, and it turns out that it inhibits a number of kinases. It actually targets very well the so-called BCR-ABL, which is the product present in CML when you have the Philadelphia chromosome, and you end up with an activation of the so-called ABL kinase. And it's really a beautiful inhibitor there, but it also inhibits other kinases. And one of the kinases it inhibits, which has been kicking around in prostate cancer lore for a long time, is the so-called SRC kinase. And SRC has been implicated in prostate cancer growth in a variety of studies going back 15 years, but there really wasn't an agent to be able to hit it. And then there's another interesting thing about SRC is that it also interacts with the osteoblast. So you end up in a situation where you might be able to alter bone stroma, alter prostate cancer growth. And so there are trials now looking at dasatinib in combination with docetaxel. And then there's some of these newer agents, trials and planning, OGX-011, Kustrosin, it's an antiapoptotic regulator, and AT101, which is another one that's being sort of touted as a pan-BCL2 inhibitor, apoptotic regulator type thing. So whole series of trials now going forth in this kind of with docetaxel. And maybe backing up 1 second just for clarity's sake, the hormone refractory space castrate-refractory state, is being looked at in a pre-docetaxel, post-docetaxel, or with docetaxel drug development paradigm. So the pivot is docetaxel because that's where the overall survival has been shown. So the question is, do you come in before it? Do you come in after? Do you come in with it? And virtually all the trials are managing one of those three spaces.
Can I ask you a question, Oliver?
Please.
You'll get the concept right away, but it's a complicated question. I recognize that there's not a simple answer, but I'd really love to hear your thoughts. And that is, you know, when, say, a classic cytotoxic like docetaxel was developed, it's kind of, you know, typical thinking in our discipline, linear, right? Cytotoxic, high PSA response rate in early phase trials. In the phase 3 trial, good PSA response rate, delay in disease progression, and a modest overall survival benefit, right? It all fits. Mm-hmm. But we have many examples of different kind of patterns of results mm-hmm. in randomized phase 2 and in some of the phase 3 trials. So, for example, in the SPARC trial, nice delay in disease-free survival, no corresponding overall survival benefit. And then in phase 2, we see these trials like the ASCENT 1 trial where there was no disease-free survival or PSA response rate, but a suggestion of an overall survival benefit that ultimately didn't appear in phase 3. The OGX compound that you raised, sort of similar story, although it's a randomized phase 2, broadly similar PSA response rates, no difference in disease progression, but a suggestion of an overall survival benefit. So my question to you is, recognizing the answer might be complicated, is how do you think about the results mm-hmm. of, say, randomized phase 2 trials in both the design of the phase 3 trial and then the likelihood of success in phase 3?
I love the question. And it goes really beyond the trials that you made note of. So the ZD454 trial that was randomized phase 2 had no benefit with regards to progression-free survival, but had an overall survival benefit. And if we go to the sickle cell T, the vaccine trial, and it's not just sickle cell T, there's another one called PSA Tricom, same thing. You know, nothing for progression-free survival, but overall survival benefit. And how do we deal with this? And one thing I think that is relevant, and this honestly has been incorporated into my thinking, is that the way we measure progression really may not be best in terms of interpreting these data. For instance, let's just say the following. If a patient has 500 bone lesions, okay, to exaggerate perhaps, but and they develop two more, that has actually been called progression in a number of these trials. Two new bone lesions is evidence of progression. Well, in terms of the overall magnitude of the disease and the percentage of increase, then that, in fact, may not be a relevant measure of disease progression. Now, let's take PSA just for a moment. So I was part of the PSA working group one, where we sat around a table and scratched our heads and tried to figure out what is PSA progression. And so we decided with all of our wisdom that, well, if you had a decline in PSA and you had your PSA increase by 50%, and it had to be a minimal increase of 5, I think it was, then that's progression. Well, the patient who has a PSA of 1,000 and then drops to 0 and then goes to 5 has PSA progression. It doesn't speak about the kinetics. So today, I'm thinking that some of the concepts that we had regarding disease progression may not have been well thought through. And perhaps even importantly, just like we started thinking about PSA, like PSA after surgery, oh my God, the death is imminent. When we got the PSA kinetics incorporated into our thinking, we did so much more. That's the Pound paper that I alluded to a little bit earlier, helping us to understand that patients can progress at different rates. And this may explain some of the issues, like for the OGX-011 data. The interesting things that occurred may have actually occurred after progression was measured because the kinetics of the disease changed. And I think that's going to be true also for the sickle cell T. And there we have kind of a preconception over the idea that it's going to take a while for the immune system to get sort of revved up, and you might end up with progression before the immune system really gets kicked in. But what we really need to be better at measuring is the kinetics of disease progression after these agents, and perhaps moving a little bit away from these dichotomous, has progression occurred or not, particularly since the definitions we use may not be so good. I don't know if that answers your question, Matthew, but that's my current thinking. And I must admit it's a problematic area because we now have a multiplicity of trials where progression-free survival and overall survival do not seem to be well connected.
One thing I want to ask you about, Matt, we actually tried to get William Oh to come here, but he wasn't able to. But he presented a really interesting paper at ASCO looking at neoadjuvant therapy with chemo. Actually, it was chemo-bevacizumab. I was kind of surprised they didn't have any hormones involved there. I haven't seen that much. Can you talk a little bit about that?
My way of thinking, and I'm not sure that this is shared by most medical oncologists, but I think that there's a variety of really interesting, primarily translational questions we can ask with neoadjuvant therapy. I don't think we know definitively answers to even maybe broader questions about, like, is there a role for neoadjuvant androgen deprivation therapy? I recognize that's been studied and best studied in Canada, but I suppose some of those questions haven't been totally exhausted. But if we take our most effective systemic therapy, androgen deprivation therapy, prior to prostatectomy, the complete response rate is approximately zero. And there's been no demonstration of benefit in the randomized trials that have been done. So I am concerned about the actual drug development in that setting with the goal of actually changing paradigms of care. I think it's an absolutely terrific space to study drugs in patients with high-risk disease, but they're really primarily translational questions where the main advantage is that you get tissue post-treatment in enough quantity to do elegant molecular studies. But I don't believe that that's where the field is moving clinically, that we'll be routinely giving neoadjuvant treatment, except unless one of the phase 3 trials is positive.
You know, one of the trials that's talked about the most, again, done at your place, was looking at rectal cancer neoadjuvant therapy. That's where a lot of the tissue normalization hypotheses came out, and they studied it on 10 patients or something extremely intently, trying to understand how that worked. What about the study, though? I was surprised because they used docetaxel bevacizumab, and they saw a fair number of objective responses. I guess you'd have to indirectly compare that to what was seen with docetaxel neoadjuvantly. What was your take on it?
Yeah, again, I mean, I think the molecular studies are very elegant, and that's where we can learn a lot about the biology of the disease that may take us in previously unexpected directions. But if we take the example of just to think really in terms of how does this impact the clinical management of the disease, I think we have to look at a disease like breast cancer, where the metric for success probably it needs to be pathologic complete response rates, for example, in inflammatory breast cancer. And we're just not seeing that in prostate cancer yet.
Another drug that's being looked at is alpha-redin, which is a radium isotope. This also bone-seeking area has kind of gotten reactivated. And just, you know, mention that for the sake of completeness, it looks quite promising in terms of the phase 2 data, and there's a phase 3 trial going on now. My second point, just about the neoadjuvant story, which was really a great disappointment for urologists. And we did two studies in Canada, as you alluded to, and one of them was a large one, 3 versus 8 months of neoadjuvant, because at the time it was designed, 3 months looked like it was going to work. It was a mistake to do it that way in retrospect. But although it showed no overall difference, it did show in high volume centers there was a benefit. And there was not a benefit in the low volume centers, and it washed out. And I think that the neoadjuvant question hasn't been adequately addressed in a study that's really enriched for high-risk patients. So it had all the problems of insufficient events, and it's probable that low-risk patients are not going to benefit from neoadjuvant therapy, and yet that was the predominant group of patients in the trial.
Any questions for them about new agents?
As far as I think it might be for the urologists who are listening, this whole issue of the stock that you put in PFS versus overall survival differences, just to comment, you know, how do you view the, where you do have PFS difference, but no difference in overall survival? Maybe you could comment on the degree to which that still means that a drug has some promise.
Yeah, it's certainly an issue in almost every cancer. You know, you see these trials that you all were talking about, and a lot of the issue relates to how much harm are you causing by therapy, because clearly to slow the tumor down is some benefit. Oliver?
Well, you know, if I had to choose an endpoint that I'm going to pay attention to, it's going to be survival, of course. And, you know, when we see these trials where there are some disconnects, and now we have a really big trial where there's a disconnect, and that's the trial that Paul knows a great deal about, the IMPACT trial with the sickle cell T. And it's very conceivable that the progression-free being sort of a dichotomous point that I tried to make earlier, I mean, it's either progress or not progress, is not really the most relevant issue. But the most relevant issue is, does it change the kinetics of the disease? And unfortunately, people are continuing to die after these therapies. But when they die at different rates, to me, that's the most informative point. Let me address one thing with the alpha radian, which I did not mention earlier, but it's a new agent. Radium-223 is a bone-seeking isotope that is an alpha particle emitter. Now, an alpha particle, as opposed to the other radioisotopes that we're using, is distinct. It's basically a helium nucleus, has two protons, two neutrons. Very destructive, but very short path. And there's randomized phase two done in Europe that showed a survival benefit, small randomized phase two. That's now in phase three. Very recently, there's been an FDA decision that allows that phase three to come into the United States. And we're going to be looking at it. I'm actually the North American PI for that trial and getting new sites on board. It's been accruing pretty well in Europe. But I think it's an exciting concept, particularly for a disease like prostate cancer that is very bone tropic, and its toxicity profile is superb. It may be able to be combined with other agents. There are trials looking at it, docetaxel in combination with radium-223 and sort of advanced planning right now. So this is a whole new area as well. So, you know, we could almost talk endlessly about all these new agents, but it's a fascinating time in prostate cancer.
Mike, any questions? Kind of taking a step back, what radiation oncologists want to hear answers to.
I think, you know, based on the successful docetaxel studies, radiation oncologists have embraced the concept of using systemic therapy with radiation therapy for locally advanced disease. The randomized trials with hormonal therapy have really made that the standard of care. And so RTOG-0521 testing docetaxel in the locally advanced setting with hormonal therapy is a very exciting study. I guess a question that I have that I would pose to Matthew and Oliver is, looking ahead 5 to 10 years in the future, and we talked about some of the significant detriments on quality of life with androgen deprivation therapy. Do you see a time where we can omit androgen deprivation therapy completely and use a systemic agent? And will our trials coming down the pike that may eliminate ADT and compare it head-on with a systemic therapy for non-metastatic disease?
Well, that's a terrific question. I hope that's the case, but I think for the foreseeable future, androgen deprivation therapy is the elephant in the room. It's a highly effective treatment. The response rate's nearly 100%, and response durations are quite durable. And while none of us are pleased with the side effect profile, in the world of cancer medicines, it's actually a very well-tolerated therapy. I'm, of course, delighted that there's been greater recognition about the side effects of treatment, but as Paul, I think, nicely said, or Laurie said, you know, it's still a pretty well-tolerated therapy. And many of the drugs that we're developing, even some of the more elegant targeted therapies, have their own set of problems that probably, for the most part, or for most of the agents, exceed the tolerability of agents like androgen deprivation therapy.
Paul?
Well, just a comment on the progression and the survival endpoints. In my way of thinking, if you improve survival, you have de facto improved or delayed progression. You just haven't been able to mark a spot on the chart to identify it. A question, Laurie, with regard to the neoadjuvant androgen deprivation trials, I presume it would have been better to have no neoadjuvant androgen deprivation versus the 9 months. The three
right.
months kind of
yeah.
blunted the difference. And Ali, what about the consolidation of chemotherapy with radiopharmaceuticals? That mm-hmm. kind of got a splash for a while, and now there's a trial, but it hadn't made the kind of impact that I would have thought would be possible.
That's a very good point, Paul. The talk that I'll be giving actually next week talks about the randomized phase twos where we don't have phase three data yet. And I think we've got to go back, what is it, about 7 or 8 years now for the splash that strontium-adriamycin did. Now, I think part of the problem has been the coordination between those who administer the radioisotopes and those who administer the chemotherapy. And actually, very recently, there were two trials in JCO, including an editorial that I wrote describing those trials, where this concept is sort of having a new beginning. And it's conceivable with a new alpha particle, which has less myelosuppression than the beta particles that have been used, it's conceivable that this could represent a better synergistic approach. And I think there's a renewed excitement in this field, but until there's data that are both safe and convincing in terms of efficacy, then it'll remain more of a heuristic proposition than one that changes practice.
I want to ask Paul to present one of your cases. Paul?
Well, the one I'm going to pick is actually very current and is a dilemma to me. He's a 60-year-old gentleman who elsewhere presented with obstructive voiding symptoms and by history and record had a digital exam that was positive and a PSA that was 35. And he was biopsied with multiple positive cores that were read as 4-4. And he had a bone scan and CT scan performed, and the idea was to provide androgen deprivation for a period of time and then proceed with radiation therapy. But in the interval, he wished to have his catheter still indwelling for his voiding difficulty taken care of, as was also the wish of the radiation oncologist, and therefore a bit of a delay occurred, and he had appropriate photovaporization of the prostate, voiding well, and was about to begin his radiation, which was advised elsewhere as being first a seed implant followed by external beam. However, he developed some back pain, not significant, but worrisome enough that a bone scan was performed, and it indeed showed one area in the L5 that was positive, and he obtained radiation therapy with good relief of these symptoms. Now, his PSA during this interval gradually fell, and when I saw him for the first time, it was 0.07. He is a wanderer. He's a consultant. And I had advised him that he should continue with his plan, potentially of radiation therapy, because he had this one solitary lesion and that perhaps local control would be important. But he wanted other opinions. He went to several centers, all of which I might say read his biopsy differently. They were all high grade, but some were 3-4, some were 4-5, some were 5-5. But there was quite a spectrum of differentiation, which is always interesting when you think about how Gleason scores are put into nomograms and how there can be quite a variety even among expert pathologists as to the call. But the interesting thing is he went to the NCI for one of his consultations, and now the bone scan had multiple areas of increased uptake, and this is approximately 3 months interval between the L5 uptake and the radiation. And the CT scan, and they also did a PET scan, showed activity in the lymph nodes, but all the lymph nodes were less than 2 centimeters. But they were evidently PET active, and they were multiple, and it was read as a likely positive scan, pelvic and para-aortic areas. And he had 2 further PSAs, both of which were 0.07. He came back again, and my recent exam shows a prostate that is quite impressive with regard to size and in duration. He's totally asymptomatic, performance status 0. And so here we have a man with metastatic disease with an undetectable PSA, with nothing to follow. I have not gotten circulating tumor cells, but my question is, and his question is, what can be done and what should be done now, and is radiation therapy a reasonable thing to pursue? He's still voiding well, and he has no local symptomatology.
So, is there any question about whether he has metastatic disease? He never had the bone biopsy, right?
He never had a bone biopsy, and I had question about that when there was a single area, but with the subsequent scan showing multiple areas,
it looks pretty straightforward.
It looks like, hoofbeats or horses.
How often do you see this?
Well, I have not seen it, and that's why I'm asking now. I have not seen someone with a PSA that was originally quite high plummet very appropriately, and then in the presence of undetectable PSA, essentially, develop local and distant progressive disease.
Paul, I saw a case that had some similarities to this very recently, and it was a highly unusual case. It was a 46-year-old guy, actually diagnosed with bladder cancer, came in, had a radical cystic prostatectomy, ended up having a high-grade prostate cancer in addition, two separate tumors. I went over this endlessly with our pathologist. And the prostate cancer had metastasized to a lymph node, and there was a extravesicular focus of disease. We ended up working him up with PET scan as well as CAT scans and bone scans. And the bone scan was very equivocal initially. I put him on hormonal therapy and then repeated the scans. And what we saw were secondarily some bone mets we didn't see before. I went back and I looked at it. I had a PET scan to compare. And there were these subtle areas. And what I think happened, and I'm going to speculate here, I'd love to hear your opinion and other opinions, is that upon treatment that you actually sort of induce that osteoblastic healing reaction, and all of a sudden, instead of a progression of disease, which would be the traditional interpretation, I think we simply had more detectable disease. And I'm repeating a PET scan on him now, and I did have this kind of diffuse area of positivity that turned sclerotic. So I think we're seeing a sclerotic healing response that explains some of that. I'd probably, given the PSA and the symptoms, I wouldn't go for more intervention right now personally. But, I mean, I'd love to hear other opinions on this type of case.
Yeah, I think you raise a great point, and I think the issue of effectively a flare, not of the traditional sort of a painful flare within a month of starting treatment,
but
a radiographic flare or detection flare is intriguing, and perhaps confounded by this man's history of having imaging at multiple different places, and you worry about the quality of the imaging and all that. So it could just be a detection bias between better generation scanners. But there's some other things going on here that are alarming, and that is it sounds like he has at least a lot of persistent local disease, which is big trouble, as I agree, and perhaps even progression locally. The other unusual thing to consider here is neuroendocrine transformation, particularly when you're telling us at least somewhere that was read as Gleason 10, mm-hmm. Gleason sum 10 to start with. And I have seen this. I mean, most typically you think of it being accompanied by liver progression with liver metastases, but it need not be the case.
Neuroendocrine
transformation. So the classic scenario is disease progression with an undetectable PSA, including with visceral metastases. You biopsy the sites of metastases, and you actually find neuroendocrine carcinoma. So it's not a second primary, it's transformation of the prostate cancer.
And you lose the PSA?
You can, yeah. I mean, ironically, the tumor may still stain PSA positive, but you can have an undetectable serum PSA or low serum PSA. You can have this with concurrent PSA progression, but the classic is PSA negative progression despite castrational therapy with liver metastases. But there are many different scenarios, and I have seen exactly that with primarily local progression. And if you're convinced that this man has local progression, I would propose rebiopsying his prostate. And if he hasn't had recent imaging, I'd certainly reimage him to include his liver. I have to say, demonstrating this doesn't do the patient a great favor. You can then treat him with regimens more typically used for neuroendocrine carcinomas with an expected reasonable response rate and unfortunately very short response duration.
Well, his imaging is within a month, and those are excellent thoughts. If he is rebiopsied, would you treat with small cell chemo regimen or radiation or both?
Well, if he truly has small cell carcinoma or neuroendocrine carcinoma, I would treat him with chemotherapy first. If he has no other sites of progression after chemotherapy, I would consider, I mean, be an unusually favorable scenario that he does fine with chemo and there's no other disease, then if you wanted to be particularly aggressive in this young guy.
Do you use chromogram and A marker?
On the tissue, yeah.
The tissue, you can measure it in the serum. I think it's the only reason I would do it is that if it were elevated, it might be a convenient way to monitor his disease, and it might be confirmatory, but I wouldn't use it as a surrogate for a biopsy of his prostate.
There's actually a little data from a French paper that I was reading recently on measuring serum chromogranin, and they were actually using a platinum VP16 type regimen, And there was a significant tendency toward those who had the higher chromogranin A's to do a little better on these platinum VP16, platinum etoposide type regimens. So there's an interesting interplay between the traditional adenocarcinoma and small cells sitting way on the other side of the spectrum. But then there's this neuroendocrine spectrum sort of in between. And it's a provocative area, and a lot of model systems demonstrate this evolution to be true.
I mean, the only thing I would take issue with is that someone said this was rare, but actually this is the classic scenario for neuroendocrine differentiation. And it's not that rare to have quite extensive, particularly soft tissue progression without PSA progression. And it's usually due to some degree of neuroendocrine differentiation.
And this is a setup, a guy presented with a big tumor, at least one reading Gleason 10. I mean, those are the folks you worry about. And if he had liver metastases, then I would say it's very likely that a biopsy would show that.
Yeah, he doesn't have those. But would you say that the biopsy of 10, and this was read by NCI and a couple of other major centers that never mentioned neuroendocrine, because it hadn't transformed yet or because there was no suspicion of it?
Presumably. There's two scenarios, I think, that we see it, and that is in a guy who presents with terrible disease, as this man did, and then has a very short response to hormone therapy, is what you're describing, with, in this case, what sounds like local progression. The other scenario are folks who do just fine on their hormone therapy for a long time and then sort of unexpectedly progress with an undetectable PSA. Both scenarios are common, but he sounds like the former group. So the absence of comments about neuroendocrine markers doesn't concern,
We've had a number of cases like this, so I agree with Laurie. It's not that rare in a situation like this. And after re-biopsying these patients, and if it was clinically consistent with the neuroendocrine picture, these patients would get upfront chemotherapy, and especially if they had large bulk disease, and I think that was the point of your case, where down the road they're going to likely run into some local problems. It's reasonable to just give external beam radiotherapy to consolidate that response. Perhaps even if this patient has other disease in the periaortic nodes, it's likely that he's going to get into trouble locally. And the morbidity of intensity-modulated local radiotherapy, I wouldn't treat the lymph nodes here. It's more presumptive palliation of his local disease would be appropriate.
How radiosensitive is this compared to, say, regular adenocarcinoma?
Actually, interestingly, neuroendocrine tumors are pretty radiosensitive, and you don't need as high a dose to achieve that kind of local control, especially in the setting of combined modality therapies.
Would you treat a guy like this with taxotere-based therapy? It's clearly prostate cancer that's de-differentiated, or do you go straight
to... that's why the biopsy is important. If you show me that he's got a lot of persistent Gleason 9-10 tumor, then you might make the argument that you would use taxotere. But if he has neuroendocrine carcinoma, then you would use a small cell-like regimen.
Does the activity in the PET scan push you one way or the other? How often do you see activity in normal-sized lymph nodes with prostate cancer?
Not so much, because I almost never use PET
scans,
for that purpose. But yes, I can't answer your question on that basis. I don't think we have a lot of data. But historically, I don't think PET's been particularly good for prostate adenocarcinoma. So perhaps by inference, it would be suggestive that there's something going on. So that's why I'm worried about this man.
The patient I mentioned that had the dual cancers, you know, the PET's not reimbursed for prostate cancer in the U.S. So I was able to get it for the bladder cancer, talk the guy into it, but he had two cancers.
Paul, why don't we talk about the two topics we asked you to talk about. Let me start out with your presentation at the AUA on SIPT.
So, interesting concept with regard to immunotherapy. I remember as a medical student hearing about Colley's toxins from Memorial, and then as a fellow heard Sir Peter Medawar talk about breaking immune tolerance, and I think we've all heard about immunotherapy as the potential fourth modality for treatment of cancer. And it may be that in the first part of the 21st century that's going to be realized. And the trial I'll speak about is the IMPACT trial, the PROVENGE trial. But just as a preliminary observation, that this is not a unique immunotherapy investigation or conclusion, was the already referred to by Ali, the PROSTVAC trial that was presented at ASCO that includes vaccinia priming and then fowlpox boosting. with the co-stimulatory molecules, which demonstrated in, I think, about 150 patients who were randomized prospectively in a phase 3 manner between empty vector and active vector, a survival benefit that was significant, although there was not a progression-free endpoint, and we've discussed that pretty significantly. So this immunotherapy idea for prostate cancer, although the immunotherapists of the 20th century wouldn't have thought prostate cancer would have been the system that it might evolve to first success in, seems to be very real. So just as a brief preliminary introduction, back in the 80s, Dendreon, the biotech company involved, performed animal studies with a recombinant fusion protein, which is PAP, prostate acid phosphatase, GM-CSF, in animal models, and found a very intense autoimmune prostatitis, and felt that they might be able to generate a therapeutic delivery for patients with prostate cancer, and went on to phase 1, phase 2 studies where safety was confirmed and where there were occasional objective responses and PSA responses, which generated in 1999 the 1901 randomized controlled trial. That was a small trial, the first of two that were planned, that randomized approximately 120 patients in a 2-to-1 ratio to immunotherapy with Provenge versus the control arm. So the way it works programmatically is patients come in for a leukapheresis. Their antigen-presenting cells are harvested. They are then sent to a facility that exposes these cells that are going to be part of the active arm to this recombinant fusion protein, PAP, GM-CSF. The control arm does not receive any exposure to the antigen, but a portion is cryopreserved. Then the products are returned, the active product and the untreated product or unexposed antigen product, and reinfused over approximately 1 to 1.5 hours, 3 to 4 days after the leukapheresis. So a Monday leukapheresis results in a Thursday infusion. And this is done 3 times at 2-week intervals, so week 0, week 2, and week 4, and that is the extent of therapy. There is no boost involved. So the patients in the 9901 trial were followed for the primary endpoint, time to disease progression, and that endpoint was not met, but there was pre-specified a 3-year look at survival, and to, I think, the relative surprise, the survival benefit was highly statistically significant.
These were what stage?
These were patients with asymptomatic or minimally symptomatic metastatic castrate-resistant prostate cancer. So all had to have a testosterone less than 50, had bone lesions, and were on, at most, mild analgesics. The story behind 9901 is was brought to the FDA at the FDA's agreement, and as many of you know, was evaluated by an expert panel that clearly defined safety with a 17-0 vote and defined a substantial evidence of efficacy with a 13-4 vote. A relatively unusual circumstance, as I understand it, maybe 1 to 2% of the time, the FDA decided not to agree or at least promote the positive vote of their expert panel, but requested further information from an ongoing trial, which is the IMPACT trial, a much larger trial with a very similar protocol, but now the endpoint of primary interest being survival and not progression, survival. So this trial involved 512 patients. Demographics and laboratory data, as you might expect with a large trial, were well balanced. They went through the same protocol that I advised before.
Where were these patients seen or taken care of?
They were taken care of in approximately 30 to 40 sites throughout the U.S. And at the time of progression, the patients were then followed at the discretion of their physician. The patients who were in the control arm, or the arm that was not exposed to the activated product, had the option of requesting that aliquot of antigen-presenting cells that are cryopreserved to be thawed, exposed to the recombinant fusion protein, and as a salvage therapy, be infused. And that issue I'll bring up again in a moment because it's a bit of an interesting twist in the trial conduct. The patients were enrolled between 2004, 2007, and unblinded just 8 weeks ago, right before the AUA meeting. And the survival curve, which was the primary endpoint, and I think we all agree that's the most definitive endpoint, the one that's of greatest interest to the patient and the physician, showed a statistically significant benefit to the patients who were treated with active immunotherapy.
What were some of the numbers in terms of the change that was seen?
The median survival advantage was 4.1 months, so 25.8 month median survival in the treatment arm, 21.7 in the control arm. The p-value was 0.032, the hazard ratio 0.775. A very mature trial, the median follow-up was 3 years, lost to follow-up only 4 patients, so a very mature trial with regard to the endpoint. There were a number of sensitivity analyses and subgroup analyses performed, all of which favored the Sepulius LT or Provenge arm, and the one that was most critically looked at was subsequent treatment with chemotherapy, specifically docetaxel, because we all know that that has a survival advantage. And when all the statistical time covariate analyses were performed, neither the delivery of or the time of delivery altered the hazard ratio or the statistical significance that benefited the Provenge or Sepulius LT arm.
How about the time to chemotherapy? Was that delayed in the patients who were treated?
It was slightly delayed, but that was assessed in the statistical jargon, and it did not prove to change the outcome. The side effects are important to discuss, mainly a mild transfusion reaction, some fever, chills, easily controlled with acetaminophen and diphenhydramine. Only 1% of patients withdrew because of, quote, toxicity, and that contrasts significantly with chemotherapeutic trials where the withdrawal rate can be 15% or more because of side effects. Only the three therapy infusions, as I mentioned, or the three infusions separated by 2 weeks, or a very convenient and short treatment time that would be very convenient for patients.
Were objective responses observed outside the bone, for example?
Objective responses were rarely seen, and PSA was not one of the endpoints. The question is, why don't we have more PSA readings and why aren't they available? PSA was part of the time to progression analysis, but once patients progressed, PSAs were not subsequently obtained on a routine basis. It was just the survival endpoint that was looked at. So, I mean, the final conclusion is that when one looks at the 9901 data and the IMPACT trial data in an integrated fashion, there's a very significantly impressive consistency in median benefit of the treatment and median survival with regard to the p-value, with regard to the overall 3-year survival, which is 32% in the treatment arm and 23%, so about a 9% overall difference at 3 years between the treatment and the control arm. And just a word about the control arm, which some critics have said, well, perhaps the control arm was unusually ill-favored, so that you had the difference because you had a control arm that was less favorable than you'd usually expect. But actually, the control arm outcome is better with regard to median survival than the control arm, for instance, of the atrasentan endothelin trial and of the tax trials as well. So, and why might that be? Well, these patients did receive, as I mentioned, as approximately 70% who were on the original control arm did receive that frozen, thawed aliquot that was now a boost, if you will, or a salvage protocol. It's certainly not the primary product, but you could make some intuitive thought process that the control arm may have been benefited to some degree and actually close the gap that might otherwise have been present between the two arms.
So what's your take on this, and if it were available, would you use it?
Clearly, if it were available, and I hope it becomes available, I would use it very readily and quickly in patients who meet the criteria, namely castrate-resistant metastatic disease.
And you'd use it before docetaxel?
I would.
Oliver?
Similar. I agree with Paul.
Anybody feel any differently? Where is this right now in terms of the FDA?
Well, the company has to put together their portfolio of all the data which will be presented to the FDA in the fourth quarter. And since a number of the events were pre-specified with regard to outcome, I think the FDA has a, we'll say, advanced expectation of what they will be looking at, but they do have 6 months to make their decision. So, you know, optimistically, the product might be FDA approved after the first of the year.
Are there other trials ongoing or planned right now?
There are three other trials. One is a trial that was initiated several years ago, termed P11, which was in patients with a rising PSA after radical prostatectomy, randomized to, first they were given androgen deprivation to level the playing field with regard to the PSA. They were then randomized to the same protocol, either active exposed arm with the antigen or to the control arm, and they're being followed now. There's been a preliminary assessment, and one of the endpoints there is PSA kinetics, and there is a favorable impact on PSA kinetics, but the long-term endpoint of progression to metastatic disease is still far off. There's a neoadjuvant trial that is currently enrolling of 30 patients prior to radical prostatectomy. Again, the three treatments and subsequent to radical prostatectomy randomized to a single boost or to not any further boosting, with the analysis of not only the radical prostatectomy specimen, but analysis of certain immunologic profiles. And then there is currently a trial that's called PROACT that is looking at three different antigen concentrations, looking at, again, CD54 upregulation, which is one of the tests for efficacy, circulating tumor cells, and other immunologic profiles.
Any questions anybody has?
Maybe a brief comment, and Paul alluded to it. So, you know, these trials take a long time to mature, and there's a little bit of a checkered history, you know, FDA panels voting here and voting there. This other vaccine, this PSA Tricom Vaccinia Fowlpox vaccine, was a bit of a tragic story. The company that found it actually ended up going bankrupt before the trial matured. And finally, the trial matured. Phil Kantoff presented at ASCO this year, and it looked almost exactly like the D9901, sort of lending credibility to this, first of all, absence of progression-free benefit, but an overall survival benefit in the long-term analysis. So, you know, I had become pretty skeptical in this whole field, and this is a large, well-conducted 500-patient trial with survival benefit. We have corroborating trials, not nearly the size, but in concept, that are very similar in their findings. And all of a sudden, I think it's become a very provocative area.
There was a lung cancer presentation last year on cetuximab where they saw survival benefit 5 weeks, but it was statistically significant and no progression-free survival benefit. And the lung cancer people were saying, we've never seen that before in oncology. Is it something that's seen, survival benefit without progression-free survival benefit? And how do you explain it?
Well, we have a number of trials now, the Prostavac trial, the Provenge or Impact trial, the trial with regard to atrasentan, that have shown that our ability to measure the progression in an accurate fashion to predict survival is lacking. So, I mean, everybody will agree that survival is the undeniable endpoint and that is the focus of the patient and the physician's desires. So I think the other stuff in the middle is a bit noisy.
Interesting. Let's talk a little bit about abiraterone.
Well, first let me say that on looking at abiraterone and some of the other hormonal therapies, I think our definitions that we use kind of casually, namely castrate-resistant disease, need to be reassessed, because what does that mean? Does it mean a testosterone less than 50, less than 20, less than 10, and now we can measure testosterone with ultrasensitive assays of less than 0.1? And then we have to deal with tissue testosterone, i.e. tumor testosterone, or the ability of the tumor to, of itself, in an intricate fashion, to produce its own T levels. So the castrate-resistant, I'll say, nomenclature involves a spectrum of issues that I think need more of a firm definition. Something I didn't realize until recently was that the labeling for LHRH agonists states that one should monitor periodically testosterone levels, which I dare say I didn't do until recently. Only when a patient was on an LHRH agonist, PSA began to rise, I get a testosterone to make certain that the testosterone was less than 50. But to monitor it during the treatment period was not a routine, and I dare say is rarely a routine. But I'd like to point out that there were two very interesting studies. One was reported in the journal Urology from Spain, and the other was presented at the AUA last year, both of which showed a significant relationship to the testosterone level at the time of LHRH delivery and the subsequent appearance of, in the one study, androgen-independent prostate cancer, and in the other study, to survival. And basically, if your T level is less than 20 versus 20 to 50 or greater than 50, the outcomes were statistically significantly different. And so I think we, even before getting to abiraterone, probably could do a better job with the agents we have to secure the fact that our testosterone is not wandering in the 60 to 70 range and potentially, while lowering the PSA, not impacting the tumor as significantly as it should. So, I mean, as an analogy, if we have a sick patient with a fever and chills and we give him an antibiotic and he feels better but the culture is still positive, i.e. the PSA is the temperature and the culture is the testosterone, you know, we've got more work to do.
There's other data about testosterone at diagnosis in metastatic prostate cancer, low testosterone being associated with, in that case, a worse survival, the notion being that sort of the treatment effect of lowering testosterone is the problem. There is data that has also shown that obesity is associated with a higher testosterone nadir during GnRH agonist therapy. There's a variety of potential mechanisms for that, but that may also explain why obesity is such a consistent predictor of worse prostate cancer mortality in a variety of settings, meaning obesity may confer a worse response to a GnRH agonist, and I think it fits nicely with
but
what you
said. But, you know, if the androgen receptor is our current target and the continually active target, it sure makes sense that you are going to get a better outcome if your T level is lower and lower and lower. And abiraterone, while it may have other mechanisms with regard to interfering with tissue T, can lower the testosterone to less than 1. And in addition to dealing with extra testicular testosterone, I think part of the explanation of why ketoconazole and abiraterone work when, quote, someone is castrate resistant. Well, they're castrate resistant only because the test we use doesn't allow testosterone to be measured accurately.
One point that I think that is important to make is serum testosterone may be only part of the story. And there are two sets of data that I think are very influential in my own mind. One is from a urologist by the name of James Moeller, who started biopsying prostates or doing TURPs within the context of this castrate refractory disease. And what he found was that the testosterone in the cancer was nowhere nearly as much suppressed as it was in the bloodstream, and laying the foundation for the hypothesis that the cancer is actually manufacturing its own testosterone for its kind of local consumption. There have been subsequent studies, and Steve Balk up at Harvard was the one who showed it initially, is that a whole series of enzymes necessary to synthesize testosterone, which are ordinarily at very low levels in the prostate cancer, that after castration occurs, that these enzymes become dramatically upregulated, implying that it's testosterone that is being potentially manufactured by the prostate cancer cells. And this concept is very important in terms of the rationale for these new androgen axis targeting agents, the abiraterones, and actually Takeda has a newer 17-alpha CYP17 inhibitor similar to the ketoconazole similar to abiraterone. There's one coming out of a lab in Maryland. So, you know, these compounds are now pushing forward. The new MDV-3100, which is probably a better anti-androgen. And so this axis really has been revived. And it's not just the serum testosterone. It may be the local generation of testosterone that makes a difference.
You know, the interesting thing is, if you look back in history, there was an endocrinologist by the name of Geller.
Geller.
In 1978, it was just 5 or 10 patients who took PUR chips from patients who had prostate cancer and found the same thing. He said, hey, guys, it's the testosterone or the androgens in the tissue that may be more important than the serum testosterone.
Just 2 points. The paper you're referring to, I think, is by Marotti.
It is.
He also showed in the same paper that the response to anti-androgen with bicalutamide as combination therapy was much greater in patients who had higher levels of testosterone. So this kind of may be one reason why the combined androgen blockade story didn't show clear evidence of a benefit in the past, because it's really just the patients whose testosterone is creeping up who benefit. But having said that, the data on intracrine synthesis of androgens really undermines the idea that somehow you got to achieve low levels of testosterone, because the cells are generating their own androgens. This is at least my view of it. What difference does it really make if the testosterone is low or dramatically low when you've got local androgen synthesis? And the other trouble I have with this whole story is there's now at least 2 large randomized trials of intermittent versus continuous therapy that basically show the survival is the same. So how can you sort of get on your high horse and say, gee, the testosterone got to be as low as possible, when stopping androgen deprivation completely for a fairly prolonged period of time doesn't make any difference in terms of prostate cancer mortality? So to me, the jury is still out on this one.
Well, I hear what you're saying, but from the first standpoint, yes, the tissue may produce testosterone, and therefore there's an internal source, but I wouldn't negate the fact that what is present in the serum might be adding to that, we'll say, total sum driver. And then with regard to the intermittent therapy, is there, we'll say, a cut point or a level above which, if you have testosterone 100 or 200, does it matter? But is that the same thing as if you have a testosterone of 40 or 20 or 10? So I think there's a rheostat that you might have a cut point whereby lesser is better, and then you get to a certain point where adding more hardly makes a difference. Don't know, but it's kind of interesting that there's an FDA label, not that that's a major factor in our academic thinking, but it's a factor in our, we'll say, our practice protocol to suggest that. The fact that it hasn't been done, and the fact that I think if we had more information, which we certainly can get pretty quickly, because everybody's on LHRH agonists and everybody draws a PSA, we're starting to get some testosterones too to see where it sits.
Can you talk a little bit about what we know about abiraterone clinically?
Yeah. So abiraterone is a CYP17 alpha hydroxylase 17:20 lyase inhibitor. And as we remember, steroid biosynthesis, it's the vertical and there are horizontal paths, and one starts with cholesterol, and the top horizontal path goes from cholesterol to pregnenolone to progesterone to corticosterone to aldosterone. And then there are the vertical paths that then generate the different androgens, and these abiraterone will block the enzymatic delivery to the testosterone and the other androgens. And there are 2 published reports come from Royal Marsden Hospital in general, one in patients who have had chemotherapy and another group that were chemotherapy naive, approximately 50 patients in each group, that showed rather remarkable PSA responses, up to 20% greater than 90% fall in PSA, 60 to 70% greater than 50% fall in PSA, but most impressive objective responses of between 15 and 30%. And this led to the 2 large trials that are now ongoing. Well, the first one, which was abiraterone plus prednisone versus prednisone alone in the chemotherapy failure setting has closed and is accrual has been completed over 1,000 patients. The other in the chemotherapy naive setting, namely just like the Provenge data, castrate resistant or Provenge eligibility, castrate resistant metastatic disease is currently ongoing. And interestingly enough, the major side effect is fluid retention and mild hypertension and hypokalemia, because that aldosterone is driven to a higher level than you would otherwise, and not necessarily glucocorticoid deficiency, because you have a lot of corticosteroid, which is an adequate glucocorticoid. But I don't know if this is familiar to our other speakers. It certainly wasn't noted by me that because you build up high levels of pregnenolone, you may get a second response when abiraterone by itself fails by adding dexamethasone, because that will suppress ACTH, suppress pregnenolone, and pregnenolone is one of those promiscuous androgen receptor ligands. So it's an interesting flow of too much at one time, too little at another time, and making the mix just right.
Where are we in terms of the FDA and abiraterone?
The current trial, which has been completed, has not been unblinded. So I would say it should be relatively soon, because it's in a very high risk group of chemotherapy failures. Then, of course, the results have got to go to the FDA, which is a 6 month. Then they've got another 6 months. So we're talking, I guess, a year or more before, which is an optimistic probably statement.
Any comments or questions?
Yeah, the trial's initially intended to report out in June of next year, but it accrued faster. So I'm thinking it'll be first quarter, early second quarter next year when we'll get results. And then the FDA clock, assuming it's positive, then the FDA clock starts from there.
So the last thing I want to just briefly touch on, we started doing prostate cancer education, I think it was around 2000, was it? And one of the first things that we did actually was talk to Paul at that time. And we've been working with him over the years. And actually, in that first interview, he shared with us and I guess all our listeners across the country his own personal history. So every time we get together, I like to sort of touch base and see what he has to say. And we actually had a roundtable a few years ago of a dozen oncologists, urologists, and radoncs, all of whom had prostate cancer. And Paul was part of that. It was really an interesting day, you know, getting the perceptions of people who've seen the disease on both sides of the stethoscope, so to speak. So I asked Paul if he would mind sort of sharing what's happened since we saw him last.
Well, since I saw you last, I had completed the salvage radiation protocol with 6 months of androgen deprivation, which was very successful in keeping my PSA in an undetectable level for about 3 years, and testosterone had risen to a normal level. Then the PSA began to rise again, and the doubling time was 3 to 6 months, so it was a bit worrisome. I thought, been preaching trials for a long enough period that I'd embark on a clinical trial. And there weren't many available. One was the Prostavac, but it required going to New Jersey, and that was a long trip, and I decided against that. The other trial that was open was an ECOG trial using the dual tyrosine kinase inhibitor, lapatinib, which subsequently has been approved for breast cancer. So I was on that for about a year, and it seemed to stabilize the PSA. Side effects were nil.
Did they test the tumor for HER2?
They have, but the results are still pending. And interesting with clinical trials, I learned a lot. In other words, the first thing is it can certainly interfere with your routine professional activities. And were I not a physician who could say, hey, John, would you draw my blood? Hey, Joe, would you do my CT scan? I would have said, enough's enough, and I can't proceed with this. I had a flight to, it was being conducted at Hopkins, so fortunately there was a Southwest back and forth, but have to fly up to get my blood pressure and my blood test and so forth. But the other thing is, while the trial has been reported with regard to its effect on PSA kinetics with some benefit, you know, the question you asked is still unknown. Was it effective in those who had that marker, the HER2 new marker, or not?
So do we know what the incidence of HER2 positivity is in prostate cancer?
I don't.
It's not very high.
It's low. I can't get
it. That's what they used to say about gastric cancer until ASCO, when, you know, the TOGA trial reported you know, an advantage, and 22% of the patients had HER2-positive gastric cancer.
I was actually the first one to look at that in about 1986, and it was like 5%.
That was in prostate?
Yeah.
What kind of test was it? IHC or?
It was Northern Blot for
wow.
expression.
Interesting.
So after a year, the PSA began to mount again at about a 3 to 4 month doubling time. So I knew androgen deprivation sooner or later, so I began sooner. And I went on the triple therapy, which is to say Casodex plus Zoladex or Gosserelin plus Dutasteride. And what was a little discouraging is while the first time I was on androgen deprivation, the PSA just plummeted to undetectable, it took about a year and it never got to an undetectable range, which would speak for the fact that the prognostic factor of undetectability wasn't in my favor.
I remember the first time we chatted when you were treated with androgen deprivation, all the various difficulties that you experienced. How about the second time?
The same set of difficulties, hot flashes, kind of lethargy. We were speaking about muscle strength. I mean, if I could press 100 pounds with my testosterone, it was 70 pounds without it. It's interesting, the quads are remarkably dependent on them, and getting out of a chair without pushing off with your arms becomes more difficult. But what I did then was rather unconventional, I would imagine. Well, I started on ketoconazole, estradiol patch, and the unconventional part would be a 2 month course of GM-CSF. And there are a couple of articles in the literature that show that GM-CSF, which is the immune driver in all of these vaccine trials, does have a favorable effect on PSA kinetics, and some folks years later are still in an undetectable range. So my PSA is stabilized at a very low range, 0.6 to 0.7, and that's where I am now. I've stopped the ketoconazole because I got quite sick, not related to it, but related to a trip overseas where I picked up one of the local bugs, and then I didn't restart it. So right now I'm on estradiol, transdermal patches, which I must add keeps my T down, abrogates hot flashes, helps my bone, and is not really, I'll say, too bad a therapy. It's just very expensive because the amount of patches you need to keep your estradiol level high enough is significant. So I use 6 patches every other day, and that runs about the same as LHRH agonist, $1,300, $1,400 for a 3 month period. But we have Part D Medicare. I'm a Medicare patient, and I get through that donut hole pretty quickly, and then it isn't quite as painful.
Any thoughts or perceptions of this latest stage in dealing with this?
As I mentioned to you before, it's interesting. The first time you hear the news, it's a tough one. The second time, it's still tough. The third and fourth and fifth iterations become, I won't say happier, but much more tolerable. And you say, life is good, and I'm happy about today, and if I worry too much about tomorrow, it won't be quite as good. So, I mean, I initially had a Gleason 4-4 and some experts read 5-4 back in, that was in the year 2000. So I think I'm in a very favored position. We've discussed cases that have progressed much more rapidly. I've had bone scan, CT scan. In fact, in my travels with the AUA, I had the opportunity to go to Nijmegen and have a CombiDex scan. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
What is it?
It's the nanoparticle, a ferromagnetic nanoparticle scan that can pick up 1 to 2 millimeter defects in the lymph node that Matt's familiar with because Mass General has been one of the proponents of it. Unfortunately, it's still lingering in FDA approval, but you know, it gives you a good idea of what your lymph node status is short of big lymph nodes, so it can detect micrometastases. How that would have affected treatment? Well, as Mike Zaleski mentioned, if there were a few abnormal nodes and my PSA was rising, I would have asked the radiation oncologist or Mike to hone in on those abnormal nodes and treat them much as we said we might treat a single bone metastasis.